Okay, so what I want to do is start at the very beginning. The very beginning was when time-sharing operating systems were just getting underway, and this, though many of you from the U.S. probably think this all started in the United States, in fact, it didn't. It started in England. There was the Manchester Project, which ran with a computer called an Atlas. I've never been able to get a MIP rating on the Atlas, but it seems that it's somewhere around 0.01, 0.02, something of that sort. So time sharing was one of these things where it was like you and one other person decided to time share. And I suspect that whoever didn't have the CPU probably was sitting around for a considerable period of time. At any rate, they set up a lot of the early principles of what time sharing would really mean. And, of course, after the war, a number of those people came to the United States, and some of that work started coming over to the U.S. The big project that got started in the U.S. was actually a joint project that was between MIT, General Electric, and Bell Labs. It was thought at the time that in order to really do time sharing right, you needed special hardware. And so GE was going to provide the special hardware, which included things like rings of protection and other things like that. That eventually evolved into what we would call supervisor mode and user mode today, i.e. it sort of boils down to one bit. But at the time, it was a bit more elaborate than that. MIT, of course, were providing the academic input, and Bell Labs were providing industry support. I suspect they were putting a lot of the money into it. At any rate, the project that they were working on was something called Multics, and it ran on the GE635. The 635 was a wildly successful computer, as you can tell by GE's big standing in the world of computation today. Multics, being driven by several of these groups, there were a number of people there that had a lot of really good ideas on what time sharing ought to be. And the problem was that they would sort of come up with this idea, they'd get it like all sort of prototyped out, and once they convinced themselves that that was a workable idea, then they'd move on and we can sort of see our way clear of doing that. Let's, you know, try doing this, and let's try doing that. So they didn't actually ever get to the point where they had an operational system. So the problem was that the folks at Bell Labs, you know, they actually wanted like a working time-sharing system. And eventually they got tired of waiting for, you know, the great idea to finish. And so they exited the Multics project, and all of the people that were working within the labs got to return to GCOS, which was a bit of a letdown after you'd been used to the concept that you could actually directly interact with your computer through something other than pieces of paper with little holes punched in it. So in particular, Dennis Ritchie and Ken Thompson were, you know, not about to work on this GCOS system. After all, they were, you know, they'd had a taste of what Multics might be. So instead, they turned to a PDP-7, which had been abandoned in a corner somewhere, and started working on that, playing around with it, coming up with a little sort of what we would call an embedded system today. It was an embedded system so they could run games on it, basically. At any rate, it pretty quickly became clear that the PDP-7 wasn't going to do what they needed, and they needed a bigger machine. Well, in those days, the computer science department at the labs didn't have the stature, shall we say, that it has today, and which also means it didn't have the budget which it has today. So it wasn't like, oh, we want a bigger toy, let's get management to buy it for us. So if you want a bigger computer, then you've got to find somebody that would have a budget to buy a bigger computer. Well, where else do you go within AT&T but the legal department? Well, the legal department, they needed text processing. They were tired of, you know, typing in their legal documents and then needing to change four commas and have the whole thing retyped. And so they sort of made a pact. They said, okay, you know, we got the money. We'll buy this monster PDP 1120 or whatever. And in exchange, you'll write something that'll help us do text processing, from which we got the runoff program known as ROF, which was eventually rewritten as NROF. And, well, you can probably guess the rest of that story. At any rate, sorry? The Unix came out of a pact with the devil is the comment. Well, yeah. I'm not going to touch that comment. Came out with a pact with the demon, maybe. Okay, so basically, they started writing what became Unix. The original system was written in assembly language because, as everybody knows, you can't write an operating system in anything other than assembly language. But Dennis Ritchie decided that what they really needed was a high-level assembler, one where they could write a statement that might translate to two or three instructions. But, you know, it had to be something that was, you know, real clearly, you know, you write some star I plus plus, because that would map directly to, you know, move open paren some register plus plus in the assembly language. And, well, we're stuck with that today. It's called C. At any rate, the system got rewritten in C, and in fact, they first presented their talk about the Unix operating system at the ACM Symposium on Operating System Principles in 1973. And at that point, they were talking about version 4. So versions 1 and 2, and I believe 3 were the assembly language versions, and I believe version 4 was the first one that became C, although don't quote me on that one directly. At any rate, SOSP, for those of you that haven't been to it, it's a wonderful conference. Basically, it's all academics. They all have their little pointy-hatted academic hats on, and they all talk about, they have all these wonderful academic papers. But the thing that really works well is that included in your conference registration, it's wrapped. So that you just pay one conference registration, and you get the conference, you get your hotel room paid, you get all your meals paid. But best of all, there's an open bar every night that starts right after the session ends and runs until basically everyone's face down. And the last aspect of it is that they never put it anywhere near anything that you can get to easily. So it's always a traumatic trip to get to wherever it is, you know, Orcas Island off the coast of Washington, or this time it's going to be some island off the Charleston, South Carolina. And so you sort of have to spend all day getting there. But once you're there, well, at least when we were in Orcas Island, there were like two phone lines off the island. So like, no one was going to dial up. There's no terminal room, none of this. You're forced to talk to your peers and drink. Okay, well, at any rate, with all these folks at SOSP, there were, as I said, a lot of academics, and this Unix thing looked cool because basically they were all tied to these giant mainframes run by central authorities at the universities over which, over their dead bodies, they were going to be allowed to let these university researchers start programming the thing. And PDP 1120, I mean, that was stretching your budget, but it was something that you might conceive of actually scratching together in a university and being able to actually break free from IT. Yeah. So one of the people that was there was Bob Fabry, who was a professor at Berkeley at that time, now retired. And he sat down and said, look, we really want this stuff. And since Ken Thompson was an alumnus of Berkeley, he got a little bit of inside track there, and so the CS department was at Berkeley was one of the very first to get what was then version 4, very quickly got upgraded to version 5. Well, they weren't content with running on a PDP 1120. They were going to go with the spiffy new hardware that was coming out of DEC at that time. It was a thing called an 1145. Fortunately, 1145s cost more than 1120s do. And as a consequence, it wasn't going to be possible for the CS department to afford an 1145. Does it sound like a familiar story? So they have to make a pact with somebody that's got money. Well, they didn't go to the lawyers at Berkeley because they don't have money. But they went to the math and stat department, which were big established departments, and said, hey, you know, why don't we go in together and we'll get this 1145. And they actually had to, they were just building a new building, and they had to hock one of the elevators in there. So there was for the longest time that I was at Berkeley, there was this empty shaft, which was the money of which had gone to buy this 1145. I walked up and down the stairs a lot because I just couldn't stand waiting for the one elevator that they did have. 10-story building, one elevator, right? Okay, so, but the deal is that they have to share this computer with Math and Stat. And Math and Stat wants absolutely nothing to do with this experimental Unix system. They want to run a real operating system, which is to say RISTUS. So then how are we going to make this work? Well, we divide the day into 3 8-hour periods. There's noon to 8 in the evening, 8 to 4 a.m., 4 a.m. to 8, or 4 a.m. to noon the following day. And you can't just let, you know, one group always have the optimal chunks of time, so it rotated. So Unix would run, let's say, in the noon to 8 p.m. slot, and then the next day it would get to run from 8 to 4 a.m., and then the next day it would get to run from 4 a.m. to noon, and the other 16 hours of the day it would be running RISTUS. And so you had these people on these wild time shifts chasing the slot that Unix had round and round and round the clock until they basically dropped from exhaustion and would, you know, lose sync for a day and get caught up on their sleep, and then they'd start chasing the clock again. At any rate, it rather quickly became clear that this was not really working very well, because it turned out that his Unix thing actually worked pretty well and people really wanted to use it. So in the end, the CS department finally decided that they would just buy their own machine. Of course, they couldn't afford an 1145, so they bought just a Mira 1140, but it was running the latest and greatest version 5. This would have been about 1974, and the best part was it ran it 24 hours a day. Well, 23 hours a day with a few hours out here and there for panics and crashes and reboots and so on. At any rate, this was successful, and in fact, what started happening was that they wanted to start putting classes on it. Professors said, you know, why should we be teaching our graduate students this stuff with punch cards when we have this Unix machine? Let's start, you know, actually putting some of our students on here and having them do classwork. Well, an 1140 is not going to support that kind of work. But since it was being used for instructional purposes, they could take some of the money that's colored instructional use that comes from the state, and they could use that to buy what was then the latest thing from DEC, which was the PDP 1170. Now, this PDP 1170, this was a honking machine. This was a one MIP processor. Can you imagine? What would you do with a whole MIP? Hey, it's 1975. What can I say? Not only did they get this 1170, but they got it with two disks. Now, of course, you just had one controller, but the Unix, in theory, had the ability to issue seeks on two different drives, and then whichever one had a seek completion first, you could start a transfer on. And then you'd switch back to the other one eventually when you finished this transfer, because you couldn't actually have two transfers going on at the same time. Well, in fact, this was a bigger system than they even had at the labs. So although the code was in there to do that, it hadn't ever really been debugged. Which is to say, they hadn't actually stress tested it, and believe me, when you've got a load average of 40 on your machine, it does tend to stress test things like your overlap seeks. So they began having problems where the machine would panic and hang in rather odd ways, and, well, who was it that had written the code? It was Ken Thompson. So you call up Ken Thompson, you say, Ken, we're having problems, you know, have you debugged this? Well, actually, I don't have a machine that's got two disks on it. Okay, well, we'll work out a deal with you. Since you work for the phone company, you call our machine room, and we'll stick the phone into a 300 baud modem, and then you can sit in Murray Hill and type and debug the console, and when you get it figured out, you know, let us know. So this was the first instance of remote debugging that I'm aware of in Unix. At any rate, Ken Thompson did get it sorted out, and rather quickly. But I guess it piqued an interest on his part. So he had a sabbatical coming up, and he decided that he would spend his sabbatical doing a year at Berkeley, which would have been 1975 school year, so 75 to 76. And coincidentally, at the same time, two other characters also matriculated to Berkeley as students. This gentleman you may have heard of named Bill Joy, and another gentleman named Charles Haley. And they were, Bill Joy in particular was in the programming languages track. That was the thing that really he was interested in doing his research on. And at the time, there was this just incredible new programming language that had come out that was clearly just going to sweep the world by storm called Pascal. So they, Ken had actually hacked up a little sort of a Pascal thingy, and Bill Joy just took to this and turned it into a real Pascal. It wasn't a compiler, actually. It compiled bytecodes that would then be interpreted. But he put in a lot of the whizzy things there. Like in those days, normally what happened is if you hit a syntax error, it would just bail out and quit. And it might tell you approximately what line it was, maybe even give you a general, you know, hint, like, you know, missing semicolon, but if you were really lucky. But with students who are trying to debug things and have relatively few cycles, Bill made some additions, which were would actually try and recover and say, well, you probably missed a semicolon here, so let's pretend there's a semicolon and keep going. So you'd get a bunch of errors out rather than just one or two. And in fact, it works much better than many compilers do even today in terms of recovering or knowing when it hadn't recovered and sort of getting itself reset. So that was good experience for Bill. He learned about how the Unix system worked. And he sort of cut his teeth under Ken Thompson, because Ken was well, basically the system administrator is what you'd call them today, except that your system administrator is not actively developing your kernel most of the time. At any rate, Bill sort of learned things that you ought to be doing, like it's generally a good idea to do dumps because, you lose your disks now and again, and people sort of like to be able to get their files back. And so when Ken left and went back to the labs after his sabbatical, Bill sort of stepped into that role of sort of taking care of the system. We didn't have actual system administrators in those days. It was deemed that, that wasn't sort of something that was recognized as necessary. So having a graduate student do it, that seemed like a reasonable thing. At any rate, after Ken left and got back to the labs, he put together this thing called the 50 changes tape, which was basically 50 patches that ought to be added to your kernel to make it work a little better. And Bill got this and put them all into the kernel and rebuilt the system. And that's when he basically learned, how you build kernels and so on. In those days, we didn't have things like auto-configuration or auto-restart or any of those sorts of things. So you had to have a kernel that was compiled exactly for the hardware that you had. If you had a disk compiled in that wasn't there, it wouldn't boot. If you basically, didn't put something in that was there, a lot of times it would panic when it accidentally tripped across it. In fact, what you really had to do is keep like two kernels around, one that was compiled for one fewer disks than you had. So if you lost a disk, you could boot the one that was designed for one fewer disks. But of course, you had to guess which disk was going to be the bad disk. So if the one that you didn't have compiled in wasn't the one that died, you had to switch unit plugs around so it was exactly matched. People, look back and think of the good old days of V6, and they just didn't have to deal with this kind of stuff. They run on simulators today, and simulators don't have bad disks on them. Or if they do, you fix the simulator, not the kernel. At any rate, in doing all of this editing that he had to do to get the stuff into the kernel, he rather quickly discovered that the ED editor had, we might say, a few deficiencies in terms of user interface. And so he felt that it really would be useful to, have at least a line-oriented editor. I mean, we didn't have screen-based terminals at that time. We had ADM3s, not the 3As. Those were the ones that had the marketing slogan, dumb terminal, smart buy. At any rate, the best he could do was a line editor. And Bill was one of these people that he was very good at deciding what the problem was he wanted to solve and then finding the shortest path to it. One time I was asked to compare myself to Bill Joy, and I said, there's really nothing that Bill did that I couldn't have done. But if you take what Bill did in any one year, it would have taken me about 10 years to do it. Of course, it would have been a little bit neater code and so on when it finally got done, but Bill's just like, all right, I need a line-oriented editor. So he went out and looked around to see what other people had done, because rule number one of Bill is don't spend a lot of time coming up with a good idea when you can steal a better one. And so he found the EM editor of Professor George Caloris at Queen Mary's College, London, and it had a lot of the features that he wanted, so he started from that and went hack, 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 and voila, out popped EX. So at this point, Bill had sort of two interesting systems that he'd put together. He had the Pascal interpreter system, and he also had the EX editor. So among his other attributes, besides being able to hack code like there was no tomorrow, in fact, I have a good story there. I was over visiting him one night, and he had the TV on and was watching something. He was reviewing some code that he had sitting down in front of him, and he and I were also carrying on a discussion. And at some point, I said, can we turn off the TV? I'm finding it sort of distracting. And he said, I have to see, the whodunit. And I said, you've been watching that? He's like, yeah. multiprocessing he was good at. So at any rate, he put together the Pascal and EX, and this is what he called the Berkeley Software Distribution. It was just called BSD. Later became known as 1BSD, but of course you never think of that when you do your first album, your first distribution. And so at any rate, he put these two together, and then he started, far and wide. I don't know, he'd be at conferences and he'd be telling people about it. And anyway, the upshot of it was people would call and he'd have them send them tapes and he'd spin copies. So he distributed about 30 copies of this first BSD distribution. And this, mind you now, he's being a graduate student. He's also doing these distributions by, spinning tapes and sending out mail, answering the phone, and so on. And also hacking on code. At any rate, Along came these addressable terminals. We started getting the ADM3As. And as soon as you had a screen addressable cursor or terminal, you could move the cursor anywhere you wanted on the screen. And so he said, well, great, you know, we'll take this line editor and we'll just turn it into a screen-based editor. Well, the problem was that there were some ADM3s, some ADM3As, and then we also had these deck printers that were on the consoles. And he didn't really want to have three different versions of the program so that he could support, you know, with all the different things that he was on. So he came up with this idea of TermCap, where he would isolate some of these things into strings so that he could dynamically configure the editor based on the terminal that you were on. In my view, that's one of the worst things he ever did, because that just turned terminal manufacturers loose to do any kind of bizarre screen addressing they wanted, knowing that, you know, they could always write a TermCap entry for it. We had to suffer with that for years. I mean, TermCap grew into this monster file. It dwarfed SendMail configuration files. At any rate, he finished up the getting VI basically working. And at the same time, he was a little upset with the shell. It didn't really work exactly the way he wanted. He really wanted something that was more C-like. So at the same time, he also started hacking on C shell. Now, it's always been amazing to me. Here's a graduate student getting his advanced degree in programming language, and you look at the syntax of C shell, and it just makes no sense to me. I never got a good explanation for him quite why that was. At any rate, he did an update to the first distribution, and he called this one 2BSD. This was released in the mid-1978 or so. And he actually shipped about 75 copies of that. At this point, we're going to go off and continue what Bill did, but I just want to have a little side thing here. 2BSD was the last distribution that was done by Bill for the PDP-11. However, there continued to be a lot of interest in PDP-11s, and so other folks started basically backporting the stuff that Bill was working on the VAX and others. So we got the 2.1 BSD and 2.2 BSD and so on, eventually leading to the 2.11 BSD, which still runs today on PDP-11s, much to my amazement. We'll have a little bit more about some of those, the 2.9s. Sorry?
Is it Y2K compliant?
Is it Y2K compliant? I don't know, but I know who you could ask. Okay. So we'll set aside the PDP distributions for the time being. We'll return here to our main thread. At this point, we've gotten to 1978, and the Berkeley Computer Science Department's actually beginning to get a name for itself, largely, I think, because of Bill. At any rate, they now have enough money from various grants that they're able to buy the latest and greatest coming out of DEC. They get one of these things called a VAX 11780. And they got this thing delivered in 1978. It was one of the first that came off the assembly line. In fact, when I was porting the Pascal compiler to it, I used one of the fancy instructions and determined that there were a certain set of arguments you could give to that instruction, and the instruction itself would go into an infinite loop. I sort of discovered this because I fired it up and the machine hung and got rebooted, and I said, huh, that's odd. And I ran it again and the machine immediately hung again. I said, I wonder if what I'm doing has anything to do with this. When they discovered that it was me, they said, stop doing that. Because you see, this was the only machine in the department for the researchers to use, and they really didn't appreciate having to have the thing rebooted. Remember, we're talking pre-FSCK days here and pre-auto reboot days here, so it actually was a major undertaking to reboot your system. At any rate, what are we going to run on this fancy new machine that we had just gotten? Well, you could run VMS, but we didn't want to do that. So instead, we got a pre-release copy of this thing called 32V, which was basically a fast and dirty port of version 7 Unix for the VAX. And when I say quick and dirty, I basically mean we picked this thing up off the PDP-11, which had no virtual memory, no paging. We dropped it onto the VAX, no virtual memory, no paging. You just had to wire down things in memory just like you were on a PDP-11, suck them in, and away you went. Well, that was good. I mean, at least it got us up and running. We didn't have the period of time where we were running on VMS, but it was rather limited in what we could do. Because the people that had actually put a lot of money into buying the VAX had done so because they were trying to run a thing called Vaxima. Vaxima is a differential equation solver written in Lisp. Well, I don't know, even in those days, when you typed Lisp, by the time you got your first prompt, you were up to a megabyte. And as soon as you typed anything, you were up to 2 megabytes. And as soon as you started to do anything, well, you went on from there. Unfortunately, this machine only had 2 megabytes of memory on it. So they would type Lisp, and there'd be a long pause, and they'd finally get a prompt. And then they'd type something and hit carriage return, and that's the last she ever wrote. So they just didn't feel that this was working for them very well. And they were really going to have virtual memory. And the choices were, well, VMS had it, so they would bite the bullet and go to VMS. But Bill was like, oh, no, wait. We can get virtual memory into Unix. It's easy. We'll just do it over Christmas break. And they said, okay, you have until the first day of classes in January. If it's not working, we're going to VMS. Well, give Bill a challenge. He'll find a way. Luckily, there was this guy, Olza Babagalu, who was a student also at Berkeley, had actually been doing his thesis on things having to do with virtual memory, and it sort of hacked together something that could be used. And Bill said, I don't care that it's not finished. Let's just put it in. We'll finish it after it gets there. Hack, 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 hack. Well, I happened to be working at Berkeley over that Christmas break because it was one of the few times when you could run on the machine with a relatively low load average. And so I would be there, and you'd get the login and say, log in 32V, log in, da-da-da-da. And after a while, this wall message would come out saying, I'm going down to reboot VM Unix. And all right, you know, you get out of your editor. They gave you a good 30 seconds or so before they hit reset. And you learn. You only miss that once. And moments later, boom, out it would come. Log in, you know, VM Unix. And you'd log in, and you'd be typing away and typing away and typing away. Log in, 32V. Okay. You learn to hit colon W a lot because we didn't have recovery really working very well in those days. So anyway, we were mostly on 32V, a little bit on VM Unix. As the weeks progressed, we were on VM Unix more and more, and 32V less and less. And by the time January 18th or whatever it was rolled around, everybody returned to classes to find VM Unix as the prompt. It was a little rocky for the next couple of weeks, but basically we made it through there. And the folks doing Lisp were basically happy because now they could type something and have it take forever while it solved the equation. But that wasn't actually VM Unix's fault because they were trying to run 10 megabytes in 2 megabytes of physical memory. At any rate, it then became necessary to get all of the utilities that were from 2BSD ported over to the VAX because people were used to basically having that utility suite around, and the original version 7 was pretty Spartan. So I, being also into programming languages, worked in the same office that Bill did, and it was sort of infectious being around Bill. He just was bubbling with enthusiasm about things, and I'd been starting to have trouble with running out of address space on the PDP-11 trying to do this stuff in Pascal. And he said, well, why don't you just port the Pascal over, Well, how hard can it be? It's written in C. Well, I don't know if you ever looked at the original Pascal compiler, but there was a lot of stuff. Everything was declared int. And then you just sort of knew, oh, well, that's really a char. So you'd cast it to char star and indirect through it and pull out whatever you needed. There was a lot of problems between 16 and 32 bits because things were, well, all ints, and suddenly they'd changed, except some of them shouldn't and others should. But the real bite was that the interpreter was written in assembly language, and I said, oh my God, we're going to have to port this. He said, well, the VAX assembly language, it looks a lot like the PDP-11. So he picked, I swear, the one piece of code where it actually sort of matched. He said, see, you just turn this move into move, and this into this, and this into this, and this into this. It's very straightforward. Here, you do the other 255 ops. A few weeks later, we finally had it running, and I swore I was never going to get sucked in by Bill again. Little did I know. At any rate, once we had all the utilities ported over, we had our first complete system. That is, a system that was a kernel and a set of utilities, everything that you could actually just load onto bare hardware and run. And so we had the release of the first complete system, and this came out as 3BSD, which went out in 1979. Now, Mind you, Bill's still a graduate student. Bill is still doing the hacking, and he's still doing distribution. Well, now it includes 32V code. In the past, it was just stuff that had been written at Berkeley. So now that it contains 32V code, of course, you need to do licensing. And licensing went approximately as follows. Phone rings. We just let Bill answer the phone in the office because we knew it was for him. So you pick up the phone and hand it to Bill. Bill says, why, yes, yeah, 3BSD. Okay, you need to send me a 2,400-foot tape. You have a license, right? Good, okay, fine. That was license verification. At any rate, about 100 copies of 3BSD went out under these terms, and I'm sure they all went out to people that were properly licensed because I'm sure nobody would, you know, fib or, you know, by the time the tape got there, I'm sure they had the license, etc. At any rate, things continue to develop, and now, because the system is being more widely distributed, a lot more people start to get involved. It's sort of the beginning of what I think of as... I use the term today, open source movement. It wasn't because obviously it was licensed code, but all the universities pretty much had licenses because they could buy a 32V license for some pathetic amount of money. I mean, it started at $99 initially, and after a while it got all the way up to, I don't know, $10,000 or something, but it was still a fairly small amount of money. So people were buying VAXes. They were getting their 32V licenses, which came with a tape, which they would either bin or send to Bill to have overwritten with the 3BSD bits, and bring it up on their system. So when I say there were 100 distributions, that was like 100 universities. There would be one distribution per sort of site. So as this starts to get out and more widely distributed, a lot more people start hacking on the code. And so pretty soon, we start getting these contributions coming back in. So we had job control that came from a guy that was working at YASA over in Austria. And Jim Culp, I believe, was his name. And he was one of these people also that could never quite get anything finished. And as soon as something would get close to working, he would then, you know, re-architect it to make it better. And so Bill got this and sort of, you know, sorted down and found the germ of stuff at the bottom that was good and dropped this in. Quickly discovered that the file system was beginning to limit us. We were only getting about 2% of the bandwidth of the disk. And if we changed the block size from 512 to 1K, we could get 4% of the bandwidth of the disk, which doubled throughput. Again, with one MIP machines, the disk subsystems were dramatically faster, really, than the CPUs were. In fact, for a long time, if you would take a page fault, what we would often do is we would write the data out to the file system and then page faulting, i.e. having the disk DMA it back into the page that we actually wanted to use, because that used less CPU cycles than actually doing the memory-to-memory copy. So that was the optimization that we made. Along at this time also came auto-reboot. For the first time, the machine could, like, crash and reboot itself. This was made, in part, largely possible by the fact that the first versions of FSCK were starting to come out, so that after a crash, it was no longer necessary to have a guru basically run NCheck, DCheck, and iCheck, and ClearEye, and so on, to clean things up. So with auto-reboot, it now became possible to actually have 23 by 7 operation, on average, of your system. And this again, was a big boon because it really meant that these systems could go into heavy production. Franz Lisp came out at this time, one of the early Lisp systems. And for the first time, it actually became possible to have mail travel between different machines. Now, this was managed largely by a program called DeliverMail. It was the predecessor to SendMail. DeliverMail had everything compiled into it. When it got rewritten, Eric decided that what was really necessary was that you shouldn't have to recompile your mail delivery agent every time you wanted to change something. So he created a little sort of file that you could use to configure it sort of on the fly. It was this thing called a SendMail configuration file. I don't think he still has an original copy, but my recollection was that it was about 10 lines long. At any rate, these systems got rolled up, and this was released as 4BSD. This came out late in 1980, and shipped about 150 copies. Not all 150 of those copies had to be handled by Bill, because, in fact, the university had actually taken notice of the fact that there was this sort of big thing that was going on out of this graduate student office, and started sort of sniffing around. And when lawyers sniff around, they invariably find things they don't like. And among other things, they felt that the license verification just wasn't rigorous enough. And so an administrative assistant was hired with the job of doing the license verification. Of course, that couldn't possibly take very much time, so this person was going to do other things on the side. Then they found out, like, when you really do license verification and all the things that AT&T required you to do, that, in fact, one person might not be quite enough. At any rate, the thing that made a lot of this possible is that there was a new source of funding that was coming in. And this source of funding was actually driven by none other than VMS. In particular, there's this organization, which you may have heard of, called the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. This is an arm of the Department of Defense, and their idea is that the different parts of the military needs to have some research done. So the Army wants research, and the Air Force wants research, and the Marines want research, and the Navy wants research. But they want to coordinate this and put all the wood behind one arrow, I believe is the operative term. And so they have this group called DARPA, and they all the different parts of the military feed money into there, and then DARPA is supposed to figure out the good stuff and go back and say, okay, Army, fund that. Okay, Navy, fund this. And it's supposed to have some bearing somehow on military readiness. So you have to make sure that whatever your proposal has, somewhere in there, they can point to something and say, see, this is going to help our military being more ready or something. So at any rate, the thing that was going to make the military more ready in this case was that they had all these different projects going on, and they were all running on different hardware and different operating systems and using different programming languages or assembly languages, as the case may be. And so none of these people could share results with each other because they were all on these legacy proprietary systems. And so DARPA decided that what they were going to do was they were going to settle on a piece of hardware, a certain computer and a certain operating system, and they were just going to get everybody that they were funding to use this system so that when they developed things, they could share it with the other groups. This seemed like a good idea. The operative machine at the time that just had the best price performance for the kind of grant sizes that they were dealing with was the VAX. So the only question then was what operating system? VMS? Unix? Well, clearly, VMS was the one to use because this was written by the vendor, it was supported by the vendor. Clearly you had a place you could go if you had problems. And on the other hand, the researchers are saying, oh, we want Unix. So this guy named Dave Cashton decided that he was once and for all going to just sort out what the problem was and how we ought to decide what to do here. And so he wrote this famous, what we call the VMS paper. And what he did was he came up with these micro benchmarks. How fast can you basically do something like get PID? And how fast can you basically write one byte back and forth on a pipe between two processes to measure context switch time and so on? So he wrote these micro benchmarks, and then he ran them on 4BSD, and he ran them on VMS. And unsurprisingly, VMS just absolutely blew Unix out of the water in terms of the performance of these micro benchmarks. So he wrote up this paper basically showing that VMS did all these things better than Unix did, and so clearly, in addition to the fact that it was vendor-supported, it was more efficient, and that ought to be what DARPA would standardize on. Well, a copy of this paper lands on Bill's desk. Now, Bill is an animated gentleman. You haven't seen animated until you see this paper that's on his desk. He just changed so many colors, I didn't know there were that many colors that the human skin could be. At any rate, the last I saw him, he was running down the hall with pages sort of ripping off the back of this thing, fluttering behind him, going, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. How can you test a system by how fast you do get PID? How often do you do get PID? I mean, let's be serious here. And then after he sort of calmed down, he said, okay, I think these are stupid benchmarks, but by golly, if that's the way they're going to make up their mind, then we're going to make these run like hell. And he started going in, and I'm talking about specialized tuning. So we tuned, and we tuned, and we tuned, and we tuned. And by golly, we were generating the assembly language and saying, all right, now let's see here. We got two extra memory references. Can we get rid of a couple of these? Yeah, in the special case, if we're doing get PID, we don't really have to do this set jump, so let's not do the set jump if we don't absolutely have to, et cetera, et cetera. We basically had it all working faster than the VMS benchmarks, except for one, and that was context switching. We just couldn't get the context switching down to the speed at which VMS did. And this was really bugging Bill, because he really wanted absolutely every one of those benchmarks to be at least as good as VMS, if not better. So what to do? What to do? Well, miraculously, one day, we were sitting in this building called Evans Hall, and there's this circle in front where there was sort of the vehicles would drive around. And one day, this delivery truck is like driving around the circle as we're coming back from lunch, and they hadn't closed the back door or something, and so this box just boom, fell off the back of the truck. And we tried to wave the driver down, but you know, he didn't see us. So, we can see, you know, here's this box. Maybe we can look and see, you know, who it's going to. We can get it delivered to him, but couldn't really figure that out. So maybe there's something inside a packing list. That would help. We open it up, and there's all this microfiche inside. And, maybe if we look at the microfiche, we can figure out who it ought to go to. And there's a microfiche reader in the library. And by golly, if the first microfiche we dropped in there wasn't the assembly language code in VMS for context switching. Turns out there's just a special sequence of instructions that you'd never guess, but that's what you need to do. And, of course, we packed the box up and made sure it got onto its proper destination several years later. And, all I can say is that Unix did context switched at exactly the same speed that VMS did, miraculously. Everything else was faster. At any rate, so Joy, Bill wrote this rebuttal paper and said, you know, look, these are the stupidest benchmarks you could possibly imagine, but that's the way you're going to measure it. Look, boom, 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 we do better all the way across the board. So VMS is out of there. DARPA looked at this, and it led to Berkeley being funded. So the DARPA funding of Berkeley begins in about June of 1980, and the idea is that we are supposed to take all this wonderful stuff that we've done to make it run so fast and get it right out the door, which we did a mere year later. We, of course, had to add a few other things. There was this guy named Robert Ells at the University of Melbourne in Australia. He was actually trained as a lawyer, but he does programming in his spare time, and he did this thing called auto-configuration. You may have heard of it. At any rate, the idea was that the system could actually sort of look around and see what hardware was there and configure it rather than having to have everything compiled in. It was a great idea. At any rate, that along with the tuning came out as our next release. Well, you might think that you would call that next release 5BSD. Makes sense. The previous one was 4BSD. The one before that was 3BSD, etc. But it seems that the folks at AT&T were concerned that if there was 5BSD, people might confuse that name with System 5. And you couldn't have that kind of confusion in the marketplace because they might buy the wrong thing. So I suppose what we should have done is just gone straight to 6BSD. But we didn't. We went to 4.1BSD instead. And hence, forevermore, we've been stuck in the 4. Series, never able to quite get to 5. About 400 copies of 4.1 got shipped, and the reason was that even though AT&T was shipping a system at this point, what they had to offer was version 7, 32V, or Programmer's Workbench, PWB. None of these really worked real well on the VACs because none of those systems had virtual memory in it, and surprisingly, people that ran Unix really wanted to have virtual memory. So again, what would happen is they would sell them a System 3 license, which they got a lot more money for, but they, of course, just dumped the tape and got the thing from Berkeley. At any rate, DARPA was pleased. It had only taken a year, and although we'd said we'd have it out in 4 months, nevertheless, it was blindingly much faster than most any of their other contractors ever got anything done. And so they decided that Berkeley had done such a good job that they would award another contract to Berkeley. And this time what they wanted to do was get networking into Unix. Now, you might think that Unix already had networking. I mean, after all, we had UUCP. But DARPA had more grandiose plans than that. Now, of course, you couldn't trust a university to do something as critical as implement a protocol stack like something as complex as, say, TCP/IP. But what they would have Berkeley do was design an interface, the sort of the programming interface, the API that would be used to access the networking, and they could do the device drivers to deal with things like Ethernets and so on. But when you got to the core stuff, the really important stuff, they had to hand that out to another contractor who they were sure could get the job done in a reasonable amount of time, BB&N. So BB&N is contracted to do TCP/IP, and Berkeley's supposed to design an interface it's going to plug into. Well, this gets Bill gone. He's pretty happy with this. And so he writes the 4.2 architecture manual, in which he lays out, in the space of a couple weeks, everything that's going to be in 4.2. And I'll point out that architecture manual included things like MMAP and so on that didn't get implemented for about another 8 years. But the idea was good. Oh, and this was all going to be done in 1 year's time. Okay, so he's got the architecture manual written, and it includes the networking interface. And so he's got sort of a prototype of the socket and accept and connect and so on written. And so he goes to BB&N and says, well, you know, I've got the interface, and can I get, you know, a copy of what you've got of the TCP/IP code so I can start testing out my interface? So Rob Gurwitz at BB&N, who's the guy that's in charge of doing that, says, sure, no problem. Here's a pre-release, you know, it's going to be another few months until I can basically get you the final version, but this will give you a chance to sort of test it out and test out your interface. So Bill drops this thing in, and the problem was that at that time, the backbone of the internet was 56K links. And most of the machines that we were running on were VAX 11 750s, 750s, which ran at about 0.7 MIPS. And that's what Rob Gurwitz had to work with at BB&N. And so the way the code was written, basically, he could saturate a 56K line utilizing 100% of the CPU time on a VAX 750. Well, we at Berkeley had the latest and greatest from Xerox PARC. We had 3 megabit Ethernet. Well, you'd hook up your 2 machines, which is how many we had, on this 3 megabit Ethernet, and you'd start trying to flat out do, you know, bulk data transfer across the network, and you got 56K, because then you'd peg the CPU. Well, Bill looked at that and said, well, this is pathetic. We ought to be able to do better than this. Let's see what's going on inside here. Oh, well, there's this, you know, state machine, and we go around through here and do all these indirect procedure calls and all this stuff. Oh, well, that's silly. You know, we can just go turn into a big switch statement with a few go-tos, you know. We're halfway through this state, go down to that state, you know, back up here. But by golly, when he was done, it saturated that 3 megabit per second Ethernet, and we had 10% of the CPU cycles to spare. So, well, very pleased with himself. A number of people wanted to start testing out the interface. So early in 1982, this system got released as something called 4.1A. And 4.1A then was basically the 4.1 system, but with the networking code in there. And so in the usual Bill Joy distribution method, this thing just sort of proliferated. It was like, now, this is an alpha release. Don't give this to any of your friends. Well, unless they really want it. And the upshot was that this was the widest alpha release I've ever seen in my life. At this point, another gentleman, Sam Leffler, joins the group. And Sam came to the group from a company that had a networking product. Furthermore, Sam actually had an advanced degree in computer science and recognized that although the implementation ran rather quickly, that Bill didn't really understand the full ramifications of what you needed in a networking interface. In particular, if you are providing a service, if it was a TCP-based service, when you connected, that socket was tied up, and nobody else could connect into that port until this connection finished, and then it would be closed, and then someone else could connect in. And that worked okay on some of the systems we were on, but Sam said, you know, someday you might want to have multiple SMTP connections coming into the machine at the same time. And this interface just doesn't allow for that. And so the interface got revved to basically allow for the model we have today, where accept returns a new socket, and the original accept socket you can loop back around and immediately do another accept on. So that was Sam's big contribution to the interface. And so we went through this and revved this whole thing up. And meanwhile, summer had begun to approach. And I hadn't really been having a lot to do with the project, well, other than the fact that Bill was in my office and he kept, you know, getting me to do little things here and there. But eventually, when the DARPA money came in, Bill had moved down and got his own office. He didn't have to be in the graduate student offices anymore. And so I was basically just working away on my thesis. Well, the way the university works when you're a graduate student is that during the 9 months of the year that you're a student, they pay you 49.5% time. And the reason is because if they paid you 50% time, they'd have to give you benefits. And by giving you 49 or 49.5, they don't. But since you're running basically on half pay for 9 months, your bank balance is getting pretty close to the edge. And so in the 3 months in the summer, actually 2 months and 29 days in the summer, you're allowed to work full time. Because if you worked for 3 months, then they'd have to give you benefits. So you're allowed to work full-time, which builds up your bank balance just in time to pay your tuition and then start into another low period. So June, which is the month where you transition from being paid essentially half-time to full-time in about the middle of the month, you should get a paycheck at the end of the month for three-quarter time. So comes the end of the month, and I'm gasping for air. You know, they got the stack of bills like this that I have to pay. And I go and I get my paycheck, and it's not three-quarter time. It's one-quarter time. They basically had stopped paying me when I thought they were going to put me to full-time. So I go over, and it's like, oh, man, I wonder if I can survive for three more days until they get this sorted out. So I go into the office, and I say, you know, what happened? You know, I'm working here this summer. Where's my paycheck? And they go, oh, well, let's see. Oh, well, your advisor hasn't gotten her new grant number in here yet. You'll have to talk to her. And once she gets it, then we can expedite your check. So I go back, and I talk to my advisor, and I say, you know, they need your grant number so they can pay me. And she goes, oh, my God, I forgot to redo the renewal on that. Oh, well, I mean, we knew she was going to get it renewed, but that doesn't sort of happen right away. In fact, that takes 6 to 8 weeks for that to happen. And so what am I going to do? What I'm going to do is I'm going to go down because I know that Bill's got all this DARPA money. So I go down and I say, Bill, you know our advisor, Sue. Well, you know, this is what happened. And could you possibly put me on for the summer on the DARPA grant and just give me like some little project to work on, you know, because what I'm really going to be working on my research. But, you know, and in the fall, you know, or when the thing comes through, I'll just switch back again. Bill says, oh, sure, no problem. You know, actually, I've got this prototype written for a file system. Maybe you could just sort of flesh it out a little bit for me in the summer. No, I'm not finished yet. So, of course, I do a little prototype of this file system, and, well, you know how it gets. You get going, and it's, you know, by the end of the summer, I actually have, like, the thing sort of written, and I have it sort of prototyped and running in user mode. Last time I ever used a block device in my life. And at any rate, Bill says, well, you know, you got this prototype going. Wouldn't you sort of like to see, you know, what it would be like to drop it in the kernel? I mean, that can't take more than a week or two. So you drop it in the kernel. Well, in user land, you don't really have concurrency. But when you get into the kernel, actually, you do. And so there's, well, just a few race conditions here and there, a few little cache invalidations that need to be done here and there. Oh, so anyhow, it's actually a couple more months before I have it running, completely sort of to the point where we're willing to trust it. And Bill says, well, you know, if you think it's, you know, really solid, you know, put your home directory on it. That shows you believe in the work that you do. So somehow I got sucked into doing that when I realized that there actually was no way to do backups. So I'd better write dump for this thing. So I did write dump for the thing. And then actually there was a disk failure. And so I had to write restore. And I got really tired of ncheck, dcheck, and icheck, so I, well, I guess I better get FSCK working. And, well, you know, one thing leads to another, and about 18 months later, out pop the fast file system. So a little sidetrack there on my way to getting my degree. But at any rate, I finished up that file system, and that became known as the 4.1b release, which actually started getting some test distribution in June of 1982. Unlike the 4.1a, which was very popular, everybody wanted to run it. There seemed to be a lot less enthusiasm for running 4.1b. This is where I learned, basically, that people will tolerate their systems crashing. That sort of stuff happens. But they really will not tolerate having their file system curdled. So if they bring it up and it curdles the file system even once, that they just won't touch it again after that. They're real happy to let somebody else be the burn-in phase of that. So although 4.1a got very wide distribution, 4.1b just didn't seem to get picked up a whole lot. But I had my home directory on it, so that proved that it must work. In fact, I got my first chance to do public speaking, because it was shortly after I had finished doing this, and I had never been to a USENIX conference before, and Bill says, oh, well, you know, on the DARPA money, we can take you to this USENIX conference. It's in Boston. That's our cool place. You'll like going to Boston. And I'd grown up on the East Coast, and I was dubious of this. But nevertheless, I mean, Boston in January. At any rate, I got sucked in, and I figured it'd be sort of fun to see this thing. And so we get there, and it's like the night that we get in. And Bill says, oh, by the way, we're going to be doing a presentation tomorrow. And could you just, you know, say a word or two about the file system? Sure, I can do that, I guess. You know, I figured it'd be, you know, the 30 people that cared about it would be in the room. And so I did a couple slides, and then, you know, I show them to Bill and say, you know, is this sort of what you had in mind? He goes, yeah, that looks good, but we want to look professional. These handwritten ones won't do, so I'll take them and get them typed up for you. Okay, whatever you say. And so the following morning, I'm looking for Bill, and I can't find him, and I can't find him, and I can't find him. And finally, it comes time for the session. And what I hadn't told me was that Bill was going to be the master of ceremonies. Well, Bill was really widely known. So we get in there, and every chair is filled. The rafters are filled. There's like 1,200 people in the room. And Bill gets up, and I'm thinking, well, he hasn't showed me my slides yet. He must intend for me to use the original ones that I got. And, well, okay, so then Bill says, okay, and now Kirk McCusick is going to tell you about the file system. And as I'm coming up, I says, where's my slides? He says, don't worry, I've got them. I'll put them up for you. And he slaps on this slide, and it is typeset, but I've never seen it in my life. And it doesn't look anything like what I'd written. So I just sort of turn like this and say, well, I haven't seen these slides before, but we can go through them together. And everybody laughed, and after that I relaxed, and, well, you haven't been able to get me off the stage ever since. So the upshot of all this was that people started hearing these things. I was making these outrageous claims. I was claiming that this file system ran 10 times faster than the old Unix file system. Now, mind you, we were running previously at 4% of the bandwidth of the disk, so all I had to really do was get up to around 40% of the bandwidth of the disk, and I'd look like a hero. The trick I learned quickly is pick problems where there's a lot of fertile ground to dig. It's worked for me ever since. At any rate, we had this system put together, and Bill Joy and Sam Loeffler had revised the networking and the IPC stuff. And we had finally then, Bill suddenly started getting this interest in separating the code out into machine-dependent and machine-independent parts. And I thought, oh, that's weird. All we got is a VAX. You know, what's going on here? And then one day, Bill calls me into his office and he says, you know, Kirk, there's this startup company that I'm thinking of going to. It's called Sun Microsystems. And what we're going to do is we're going to take Motorola 68000s, commodity stuff, and we're going to sell Unix on it. We're going to sell BSD. We're going to port BSD. So we're going to go out, and there's already people that are selling these boxes, but they've got System 5 on it, and BSD is going to be so much better, we're just going to blow them away. And the marketing thing that we're going to have is open systems. That is basically, you know, commodity hardware, commodity software. If your vendor doesn't do the right thing, you go to whoever is cheaper or better. And people are going to buy into this, and we're going to sell a lot of systems. And if you come, you know, you can get a single-digit employee number, and we can give you this wonderful stock option, and, you ought to do this. I said, I thought about it overnight, and I went in the next day, and I said, Bill, you know, you're basically trying to get into the workstation market. And in the workstation market, what's important is applications. And Apollo Computer is out there. They've got a 3-year jump. They've got all the applications on their machine. You know, I just don't see how you can possibly succeed. So I turned them down. Actually, I didn't turn them down flat. I said, well, you know, I'm just a few months away from finishing my PhD, and if I were to go and join Sun, you know, I know I wouldn't finish it, and I've been working on this thing for 6 years, and I really would like to just get it done. And so I'll finish it up, you know, and then we'll see how you're doing. You know, I'm sure, you know, there'll still be lots of good stock options left and so on. I recomputed what that stock would be worth today if I had gotten it. I wouldn't be standing up here. I'd have bought some Caribbean island by this time. But at any rate, by the time I finished, which actually was 18 months later, the upshot was that Sun was a huge company and had not too many interesting stock options. Although I did, I was the first hired consultant because Bill felt it was important to have Pascal. Remember, that thing was written in assembly language. And so he hired me to basically port the Pascal system onto the Sun platform. So Peter Kessler and I did that and received, I think it was 4,000 shares of Sun stock, of which I've sold most of it, and what's left of it is worth close to $1 million today. So didn't do that badly off of Sun. At any rate, I didn't, you know, bite the big ring there, or grab the big ring as the circus went around. At any rate, Bill left and went to Sun, and coincidentally, we decided, for no particular reason, why, thank you, glad someone's got my mind in mind. How many of the rest of you are keeping up here? Let's.
Here's your next one.
Off camera, I've been offered an entire pitcher. We'll get to that at the break. Okay, so coincidentally, Bill decides that maybe it'd be a good time to release this test release called 4.1c. And 4.1c has basically got the file system in it. It's got the networking stuff in it. It has the new signal work in it that's been done. And this came out in about April of 1983. And the only copy of that I saw being distributed initially went to Sun Microsystems, but eventually it did become available to some other folks. At any rate, there was talk of 4.1D, which was going to be the VM system, that was going to be MMAP and so on. And Bill had committed that he would get that done before he completely transitioned to Sun. But you know how those things go. The upshot was that Bill was gone. Bob Fabry, the professor that had sort of been running the project, was gone. And there was beginning to be a lot of pressure to release a system. I mean, it had been a couple years since 4.1 had come out. And so we said, all right, fine, you know, maybe we'll put VM into the next system. So Sam Loeffler basically finished off the signal code, did a lot of documentation of various and sundry things. And at about that time, Mike Carls from Molecular Biology came over and joined the group in about June of 1983. So Sam and Mike sort of together, with a little help from some of the rest of us, basically put together the 4.2 release, which came out in August of 1983. Just to give you sort of timeline here, System 5 Release 1 was coming out in just about the same time frame. So about 1,000 copies of 4.2 got distributed. And remember, one copy represents, for example, all the machines on a campus of a university, or all of the machines within, you know, IBM or something like that. So 1,000 copies is an incredible number of machines. What really happened was 4.2 was sort of the high point of Berkeley distributions in terms of the commercial world. And it was really a matter of freedom from choice. And you could get System 5 Release 1 with UUCP. Or you could get 4.2 with TCP/IP. Now, which would you choose? You could get System 5 Release 1 with a file system that ran at, maybe 30 kilobytes per second through the file system. Or you could get 4.2 BSD with 400 kilobytes per second through the file system. It was just a no-brainer. So as we couldn't make these 4.2 tapes fast enough. Remember I told you we had Hearst Mining Circle there? These cars would pull up and screech to a halt, and the door would open, and his hand would come out, and they'd just be waiting, you know, and we'd sort of wing a tape out the fourth floor window. They'd grab it, and the door would slam shut, and they'd tear off to their company to start installing 4.2 BSD. It wasn't quite that bad, but you get the idea. We had people that were just calling, when are you going to make our tape? It's like, we're spinning the tape drives as fast as we can. You know, we're getting your licenses verified as fast as we can, and that wasn't very fast. AT&T just wasn't in a big hurry to verify those licenses. I don't know why. At any rate, with 4.2 out the door, it gets, you know, starts to go into distribution. And of course, one of those tapes, actually, the first seven tapes had to go to seven designated DARPA recipients. One of those DARPA recipients, of course, was BBNN. Well, BBNN got their tape, and despite the fact that they had sent us their final TCP/IP code, they were very upset to discover that we hadn't put it in. We were still shipping with that prototype that had been hacked beyond belief, and how could we do this? Their reputations, after all. Besides that, DARPA had spent, you know, five times as much money for BBNN as they had for Berkeley, and then we hadn't gone and used their work. So, you know, DARPA wasn't getting their money's worth. Well, at this point, they began agitating that their latest release really should replace the TCP/IP that was being distributed in 4.2. And, you know, they came to us, they complained, we said, well, no, we don't really want to. And so then they went to DARPA, and DARPA said, look, you can't just not do this. You have to, you know, sit down and at least evaluate, you know, these two systems. And so Mike Carls, who joined the project and had gotten up to speed on things, was tasked with evaluating what we had and the one that had come from DARPA. And he went through, and, you know, DARPA got, or the BBNN got some good points for, you know, modularity and things like that. But the fact of the matter was that the one that had been in BSD, I mean, it had been gotten very wide distribution, starting with 4.1a. There'd been a lot of tuning done. There'd been a lot of debugging done. There'd been a lot of enhancements to the algorithms done. And the upshot was that, you know, there wasn't enough to be gained by putting in the BBN code and then have to carry, you know, port across all that tuning and debugging and enhancements and so on to basically make it worth their while to do the conversion. So BBN said, okay, fine, you know, we'll put all those enhancements in and we'll do this and this and this and this and this. And eventually they sent us yet another copy that supposedly had all of the tuning and debugging and so on and so forth. And so the upshot is that we still didn't think it was any better. Well, or at least Mike didn't think it was any better, and he was the one making the decision. So what we would basically do is we would make these big announcements at USENIX conferences. There used to be two a year, one in January and one in June. And so at the June 1985 USENIX conference, we basically announced that 4.3 BSD was going to be released, quote, in late summer, unquote. I mean, we were famous for never giving dates for anything, but we figured in late summer, you know, that, you know, October's sort of late summer, don't you think? at any rate, we learned our lesson. We never made any more guesses, even as to seasons after that. at any rate, as soon as we made this announcement, BBNN just went ballistic. They just said, look, you've not taken our code. You've not given us a good reason why you haven't taken the code. And they went to DARPA, and they just basically whined and moaned and groaned. And so DARPA just got tired of this, and they did what the military organizations generally do. They came to a decision as to what should be done, and then they told the parties what the decision was. And the decision was that Berkeley would replace the TCP/IP code in 4.2 with the code from BBNN. Well, those of us at Berkeley, as you might imagine, due to the heritage of the town in which we live, don't take military orders in the spirit in which they were intended, shall we say. We had the temerity to object. We said, well, we don't like your decision. And when the shock came off their face, we decided that maybe we'd better fill the gap of the silence, and we said, look, we will offer a compromise. What we'll do is we will incorporate the BBN functionality. We will basically have the BBN TCP/IP will be in one subdirectory. The Berkeley TCP/IP will be in another subdirectory. And there'll just be a flag in the kernel configuration file. I want this one. I want that one. And let the people decide. It's not up to us. We'll give them the choice. DARPA wasn't that stupid. They said, look, two versions out there? No, we're not going to do that. They said, okay, finally, here's what we're going to do. We're going to run field tests We've had, you know, BBNNs run their tests, and they've come up with one conclusion. You've run your test, you've come up with a different conclusion. What we need is an independent third party who can do this and won't be biased by being one of the implementers. And so they cast about to try and find somebody, and they finally found this guy named Mike Moose at the Ballistics Research Laboratory in Aberdeen, Maryland. And BBNN people hadn't really heard much about him, but they'd heard, you know, that he knew something about networking, so they agreed to it. And he was a big contributor to Berkeley, so we were happy with having him. And at any rate, he ran his tests. And one of the things that DARPA was very concerned about was what happens when you have a high packet loss. You know, for some reason they felt that there might be environments that this would run in with high packet losses. And so it was important that it should operate well in this sort of an environment. And so one of the tests that got run was basically putting something into the driver where it would randomly drop, I think, every fourth packet, or, you know, on average, one out of four packets, and then see how well the thing recovered from this. Because basically, if you just ran them head-to-head without losses, they both ran pretty much the same speed. So the report comes out, and it starts off, you know, you get this report, and you just, like, you want to, where's the conclusion, you know? But he carefully hides the conclusion in the middle, so you actually have to read the thing. And so you sit down after you can't find the conclusion by reading the first and last paragraphs, and you start reading through it, and he says, well, you know, I ran the two systems, and without loss, they basically, you know, sometimes one's a little better, sometimes the other's a little better. He said, but we finally get to the point where we do the lossy testing, and this is where the difference between the systems really shows up. And we're thinking, oh, God, I mean, this is the thing that BBNN is claiming is what they really do well. And so we start reading, and he says, and not to our surprise, the BBN code jumps off to an early lead in the system. But Berkeley catches up during the time that the BBN system is rebooting, and in the end... Berkeley moved to release the Berkeley code as 4.3 in June of 1986, because by golly, we were not going to go back to USENIX and have to stand up there and say that 4.3 hadn't been released yet. What we did learn was when we said late summer, we didn't say which year we were talking about. Okay, so let's cut it off here for now. Basically, June of 1986, because by golly, we were not going to go back to USENIX and have to stand up there and say that 4.3 hadn't been released yet. What we did learn was when we said late summer, we didn't say which year we were talking about. Okay, so let's cut it off here for now. All right, during the break, someone pointed out that I never mentioned when I actually got to the project. That would have been back in January of 1985. Because come hell or high water, I was going to finish my PhD in 1984 because I felt that George Orwell would approve of completing a computer science degree in 1984. And I did by about 10 days. Okay, so we've managed to get 4.2 out the door, and at this point, Bill Joy has left, and we're sort of starting to restaff the project here. And so the way the university works is that they pay rather poor wages. So in particular, they have to have lots of perks. So for example, when there's somebody that's considering coming to work for us, one of the perks is that they get to pay their own expenses to come out for an interview. to, you know, try and make it as easy as possible, I said, well, you know, you don't have to pay for your own hotel. You can come stay at Shea Oxford, which is our guest house. So anyway, Keith Bostick takes us up on this offer and comes out to interview, and he seems like he's going to be a great person, but he has one requirement that, you know, one of the requirements that if he's going to come to work for us, we have to agree to let him finish up some work he was doing on basically getting 4.3, ported over to the PDP-11, which is going to be the 2.10 or 2.11 distribution. Well, Mike and I look at each other and we say, you know, that's a really challenging problem because, you know, you're basically taking something that's over 200K of text and you have to figure out a set of overlays to cram this thing into 64K. We really, between the two of us, think that this is probably not possible. But If that's what it takes to get Keith to come, then fine, you know, he can work on that project in his spare time. Now, you have to understand that we were in the lean and mean mode of staffing. So for Keith, we divided his job into three parts. For one-third of the time, he was going to be responsible for answering the phone and providing technical support for our users. Now, we didn't really provide technical support, so basically if they called up and wanted to know, you know, how to set a term cap entry, he was free to say, go find out by reading the manual. But if they called up and it was something interesting, then he would work with them to sort it out, and especially if they had a bug fix in hand. So that was one-third of his job. I mean, after all, we only had, you know, 1,000 distributions in the field or so. And so then the second third of his job was that any email that came in to report bugs was his responsibility to look at, decide whether it was reasonable, categorize it, fix it, close it, you know, that sort of thing. And one-third of his time was to do development of things, you know, because we had to give him something fun to do. And then, of course, there was the 2.11 project as well. Well, he actually did finally get that together. He showed up, this was in, I guess, about October of 1986, and he finished the 2.11 late in 1988. He sort of had come around to the view that Mike and I had, that perhaps this wasn't really the smartest thing he'd ever signed up to do. But he wanted to prove us wrong, so he did, in fact, finish it. Having finished it and gotten it out the door, we had the ceremony of taking the PDP-11 and dropping it out the fourth floor window to see how high it would bounce when it hit the cement. This was his way of making sure that he would never have to do any bug fixing on that system. Okay, so the next release that we did after 4.3 was something that we called 4.3 Tahoe. Now, there was sort of a long debate as to, you know, should we call this 4.4 or should we call it something else? I sort of was of the opinion that we should just call it 4.4, but Mike had the notion that 4.4 was going to have a certain set of things in it, and this didn't have that set of things in it, so we couldn't call it 4.4. So it was called 4.3 Tahoe. This came out in June of 1988, and really its primary purpose was to support a second architecture. And we sort of had done some dividing up of the code for the when Bill was leaving, but this was sort of the first time that we sat down and really did a full-fledged port. And they say in computer science, you know, that there's really only three interesting numbers, 0, 1, and many. So this constituted many, and NetBSD has proven that we basically got that right, I guess. We never did do the port to the microwave oven, but I understand that there is a version of NetBSD that will be running on there soon, as soon as they get from the 8 to the 16-bit processor. Meanwhile, the System 5 and commercial folks had continued merrily on their way, putting out ever more complex systems, including, you know, finally, networking and virtual memory and other things. But the effect of this was that the price kept going up and up and up and up and up. And a lot of people wanted to get stuff from Berkeley, but they couldn't afford the $250,000 that it cost to get the source license from AT&T so that they could basically pull the TCP/IP protocol stack out and use it in some embedded card. So there was a fair amount of pressure saying, well, you know, the TCP/IP stuff, that was really done at Berkeley. Couldn't you just release that without having us to get an AT&T license? And after some hemming and hawing, we finally said, okay, we can probably do that. And so we sort of sliced through the system, and we pulled, you know, network device drivers and the TCP/IP stack and sockets and then on up and FTP and Telnet and, unfortunately, the R commands, and put them together on a tape which we called Networking Release 1, which came out in about June of 1989, I guess. And it really was just the networking stuff. Well, The effect of this was dramatic. A lot of people got this release. We basically figured, hey, it's freely redistributable, so three people are going to get it, put it up for anonymous UUCP, which is the way you did things in that day, and that was going to be it. We'd never sell another one because basically it was like, well, do you want to pay $1,000 to the University of California to get a release of this software on an archaic media, which was to say 9-track tape, or would you rather just download it over the net? Well, the answer was that actually quite a few people paid $1,000, and I think it was partly because they, you know, felt guilty about just taking it, but also, you know, they wanted that piece of paper from the university that basically said, this is freely redistributable, have a good life. So At any rate, quite a few of those did in fact ship. But meanwhile, we got back on our main project, which was continuing to go along and put in all the stuff that was supposed to be in the final 4.4 release. And some time had gone by, actually a fair amount of time had gone by, and so we decided that we really needed to do another interim release to let people test stuff out. The 4.3 Tahoe had been named because the machine that we'd ported to was the CCI 632, which was what we felt was going to be the really big successful hot processor architecture. And it had been codenamed Tahoe while they'd been developing it. And so we just decided to call that release Tahoe. When it came time to do our next interim release, we just sort of slapped the thing together. We didn't do a lot of our typical release engineering on it. And so we decided that we would name it 4.3 Reno, partly as a play on the name of the previous release, and partly because Reno was a big gambling capital in Nevada, and it was sort of, the point was it was sort of a gamble to run this distribution. At any rate, it included a lot of sort of major new systems. We had the first of the new virtual memory systems, or we had the new virtual memory system. Up to that point, we had had the one that had been done by Bill and Olzop back in 1979, and it was very heavily tuned for the VAX. And so when people would try and port it to other architectures, the machine-dependent stuff was just riddled all through the code. And so the port was, the complexity of doing the port was directly proportional to how closely the hardware you were porting to looked like a VAX. So what would basically happen is you'd run all the way down thinking you were dealing with a VAX, and then you would just write this low-level stub code that would pull the thing out of the VAX PTE data structure, which was the central data structure of the VM system, and stuff the bits into whatever you needed in the actual machine that you were running on. And if it was an easy mapping, it went pretty straightforwardly. If it was something like inverted page tables, it's like, forget it. So it was clear that we needed to get a new VM system, if only to make it more portable, and also because we wanted to have the ability to have sharing of things other than just the text space, which really was just not architected into the previous VM system. So since I got sort of put in charge of doing this, and I didn't really want to write a VM system from scratch, because after all, that's work. And so instead, I looked around to try and say, well, there's got to be somebody that's done one of these somewhere. And in fact, there were a couple candidates. Sun had done a new VM system, which looked really cool. And I thought, well, that would definitely be a good candidate. They did it straight to the architecture manual interface, so it should drop in pretty easily. The other choice I looked at was from the mock project at CMU. The idea was to do microkernels, which I basically believed were a pile of crock, but the bottom line was that we could still take the VM system out of it without having to do the microkernel bit. And that way we could also placate DARPA by saying we were looking at mock, which is what we were supposed to be doing theoretically. And we took the best part of it and put it into BSD. Yeah. No, actually BSD is still not on microkernel, but never mind. Okay, so which one of these two are we going to take? Well, to get the one from Sun, of course, Sun has to release it. And you talk to the technical people at Sun, and they think it's a good idea, and they talk to their managers, and they think it's a good idea, and it percolates up for a while, and you talk to Bill, and he thinks it's a good idea, and Bill has Scott McNeely's ear, and Scott thinks it's a good idea. And so finally, of course, something that's that dramatic back in those days had to be cleared with the board of directors, and anything that goes before the board of directors has to be reviewed by the lawyers. And the lawyers looked at it, and they said, well, you do realize that your stockholders could sue you for giving away company property. Well, that was the end of that. So I guess we'll go with mock. So we need to integrate the mock VM system to replace it. And luckily, I found Mike Hibbler at the University of Utah who was willing to actually do the work. So Mike did the integration, and then I took what his thing was and sort of mucked around to make it smell like Kirk. And that was it in the system. Simultaneously, we wanted to get NFS because NFS was clearly taking over due to Sun's basically skillful marketing of it. Sun had, of course, put the specification in the public domain and said, you want to do your own, have a good life. So I found Rick Macklin up at the University of Guelph. That's up in Canada. In those northern countries, it's dark and cold for long periods of time. So basically, fall descended and we didn't hear anything, and then spring arrived, and during that blackout, Rick had gotten NFS written. So before it got too warm up in Canada, I invited him to come down to Berkeley and spend a week basically staying at Shea Oxford and getting the thing integrated into the BSD system. I mean, he had it in BSD, but getting it integrated into our main tree. And so he comes down, and we have a 5620. It was sort of a workstation type of thing, except that basically there was not a lot of smarts in it. You were sort of connected in from the main machine, but you could put Windows up on it and so on. So I said, well, you know, how do you want this thing configured? And he says, well, you know, just give me one big window. I said, well, you know, you could have multiple. No, one big window. So I make one window that's the whole size of the thing, which is like, you know, 66 lines long. And he thinks this is the cat's pajamas because, see, he uses ED, but he's not really a power ED user. So, for example, if he wants to print out a page, he just hits carriage return repeatedly. So actually on a 66-line window, you only get 33 lines of text, but that's a lot more than you normally get on a 24-line screen, which is what he was used to. This is when I came to understand why it was he had everything written in macros, because he couldn't see more than like this myopic little window that he could look at going up and down. Explains a lot about why NFS is the way it is. But at any rate, we still have it today, and you all are using it in FreeBSD, so you can't laugh too much. So we had the new VM system. We had the new we had NFS in there, and of course all the new VNode stuff, which is something that I actually did do. And this was what came out as 4.3 Reno. Well, meanwhile, the success of Net 1 led to a desire to release more of the system freely. This, of course, when I say more of a desire, there were people that were calling up. And so the person that was in charge, or the group that was in charge of dealing with incoming calls, which is to say one-third of Keith Bostick, would you know, aggregate these things. And so we'd have these weekly meetings. And you know, he would come in and say, well, you know, there's a lot of people that would like us to release more stuff. And, you know, Mike and I would sort of roll our eyes and say, yeah, yeah, yeah. And the next week he'd bring it up again, and he'd bring it up again. And finally, we say, look, Keith, you don't understand. It's not just a kernel issue here. There's all these utilities. There's the C library. All of these things are riddled with 32V code. I mean, it would be a mammoth undertaking to try and, you know, sort all this stuff out. But we don't want to hold you back. So if you want to go out and try and figure out how to do that, that's a great idea. So why don't you do that in your spare time? Figuring that was the last we were ever going to hear of it, and, you know, that would be that. Well, Keith gets up at the next USENIX conference, and he puts up a list of utilities. He's like, I need people to write these utilities. Write these utilities and contribute them to Berkeley and get your name in lights. Well, of course, people start, you know, rewriting CAT. They rewrite, you know, some other, you know, fairly complex things, OD, head, tail. And, you know, we're going, ho, 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 ho. But then somebody did TROF. And we began to realize that maybe these people were starting to get serious. Get serious. Meanwhile, Keith is getting these things in and, you know, getting a larger and larger list. And he's pounding away, getting all the parts of the C library rewritten. And so one day he comes ambling into one of our meetings and he says, well, you know, Mike and Kirk, you know, I've just about got the C library done and I've got about half the utilities done. How's that kernel coming, guys? And I look at Mike, and Mike looks at me, and I go, oh, shit. Because we can't go to USENIX and say, rewrite the kernel, get your name in lights. We're going to actually, like, have to go through this thing and try and figure out, you know, what's contaminated and what's not. And so, of course, Keith gets into the game, too. And we do things like we build an inverted database. We take all of 32V and basically run it through Beautify or something to put it in a standard format and then build an inverted database of that. And then we go through line by line in BSD, looking it up in the inverted database to see what matches. And when you get little runs of code, it's like, yeah, yeah, that looks suspiciously like that run over there. I guess we better deal with that. So anyway, mostly you just find little bits and pieces of things here and there, and so most of those can be cleaned up. And every now and then you find a file that's just really polluted, so you just mark polluted, you know, forget it. And, well, when the dust clears and we're done with all this, we realize that we're down to, like, six files that are still contaminated. And we think, huh, you know, we could just rewrite those six files, but, you know, that's just, if we release a complete system, that's going to cause a lot of consternation. But if we release one and say, well, this is, you know, broken, you can't even compile the thing, you know, AT&T probably won't notice, they won't care. So, to write a new license, we decided that we would just revise the license that we already had for freely redistributed software. So we'll just call it Net2. So we're going to use the same license you already did, we're just going to change the name right here. And they still had to fiddle with it and waste a month of our time, but eventually that got dealt with. But we also felt that we needed to just, you know, make sure that other people in the university knew what was going on. So we talked to in the heads of our department, and they said, well, yeah, it sounds like you did a reasonable job, but maybe we ought to, just escalate it up. So it's what escalated up and up and up. And the further up it went, the more nervous they got. And so they brought in people to do verification, and we spent 3 days being audited to make sure that we'd done it all right. And finally, at a very high level in the university, we got approval to release the system, which we did in June of 1991. Well, it was well received. A lot of people bought it, just like before. Even though you could FTP it at this point for free, a lot of people still wanted that piece of paper that said it was okay. And by early 1992, the bits had been out there, and it just didn't take all that long for several groups to basically figure out how to rewrite those six missing files. So the company Berkeley Software Design, by January of 92, I believe, was shipping at least an alpha test of their product, and Bill Jolitz had gone out and rewritten the files, and he had released a system called 386/BSD. And, it was looking like, it wasn't all that hard to take that distribution and basically turn it into a working system. About this time, Mike decides that BSDI looks like an interesting place to work, and he really always wanted to live in Minnesota because the Bay Area was much too warm. And so, except in the summertime when it was much too cold. So he and his wife departed back to Minnesota, and that's when he learned the first difference between the Bay Area and Minnesota, and that was, in those days, if you didn't want to pay capital gains when you sold your house, you had to spend at least as much money as you'd sold the previous one for. Well, he had sort of a ramble-down shack that was underneath the BART tracks in El Cerrito, so, it wasn't worth all that much money. But it did get him a huge spread with, some credible amount of land and, a house that sort of disappears into the horizon, a swimming pool, a hot tub, etc. But, well, there are a few differences, I guess. Anyhow, the upshot of it was that these systems were out there. BSDI in particular was shipping a product. And then they did something that was probably not the smartest move. They started running these ads with an 800 number, 1-800-ITS-UNIX. And, somebody at AT&T noticed. And they basically sent a cease and desist letter to BSDI and said, no, can't do that. So BSDI said, okay, we won't use the phone number. And they said, no, you don't understand. We don't like the phone number. We don't like the product. Stop shipping it or get a license. And it's like, but it's freely redistributable code, And so anyway, the upshot is that USL drops a lawsuit on BSDI. I mean, after all, AT&T, monster company, actually, it was a wholly owned subsidiary of, not wholly owned, 80% owned subsidiary of AT&T called Unix System Laboratory, and they figured that they probably had enough muscle that it didn't matter whether BSDI was in the right or wrong. Here you have a four-person startup company, and don't confuse me with the facts. We're going to drive you into the ground. And they wanted to make an example to make sure no one else got the bright idea that this might be usable. So the first thing they did is they filed what's called a request for a preliminary injunction. So you go to the judge and you say, we are being harmed so badly by this company, that tarnishing our reputation and cutting our cash flow, that it's important that you enjoin them from shipping their product until this case is resolved 2 or 3 years from now. So, of course, if BSDI gets enjoined from shipping their product, they don't have any cash flow for 2 or 3 years and a lot of lawyer bills, and you can sort of wonder where that's going to go. However, the lawyer for BSDI got up in front of the judge and said, well, now look, let's just look at this problem here. Here is our product. It contains this software where we have this piece of paper from the University of California that says it's freely redistributable. Then there's these six files that we wrote. They have no complaints about these six files. We're willing to talk to them about any one of these six files that they're interested in. But, you just can't take all this stuff they're talking about the rest of this system. And the judge thought about that and said, well, USL, I just really can't see any reason why this case should even proceed at all. Perhaps you want to rethink your strategy a little bit and come back ready to give me some reason why I really ought to do this. So as the result of that, USL said, I guess we're going to have to sue the University of California as well. So, boom, down comes the lawsuit at the University of California. Well, now we have you know, big immovable object against another big immovable object, which is somewhat of a fairer battle. And the people at Berkeley sort of came around and said, why is this lawsuit being filed? And we said, don't you remember all those discussions we had? And well, I did tell you this might happen. Yeah, but we didn't really think it was going to happen. I mean, you were kidding, weren't you? Well, I guess we weren't. Depositions begin. This is the first time I'd ever had the opportunity to be deposed sort of up close and personal. It's a new thing that the first time it happens, well, you may not be completely ready for it. You basically have, well, as the lawyers explained to me, this is basically going to be a soccer game. And you are the goalie, so there's no way you're ever going to score any points. What you're going to do is you're going to stand in front of this goal, and they're going to kick shots at you all day long. And basically, they're going to kick a couple hundred shots, and the two that get by are the ones they're going to snip out and show on the nightly news. And all the rest where you basically defended it, the jury isn't going to see that. So your goal is to basically deflect everything. Then he decided to put it in more personal terms. He said, consider that what you're getting is a proctate exam by Captain Hook. Unfortunately, he wasn't exaggerating. In fact, he was trying to make it easy on me. It was worse than that. It goes on for 3 days, and you're sitting there, and there's this person who does this professionally, and basically they alternate through sort of trying to badger you and make you think they're their best friend and trick you into saying things. Other times they're really hostile, and they're like yelling at you to try and get you unnerved and upset. And then normally you have your lawyer next to you, and your lawyer is allowed to object to the questions that they ask, but you still have to answer them. It's just that he sort of, you know, he sees that you're about to blurt something out, so he objects to, you know, sort of, you know, let you get your composure back or something. At any rate, I had two lawyers because I had the lawyer for Berkeley sitting on one side, and there was the lawyer for BSDI on the other side. So if they was asked a question that was somehow relevant to what was going on between the university and BSDI, they could complain. And if it was something about what went on at Berkeley, then the Berkeley lawyer could complain. And there was one point where I just knew that the university was going to buckle down and really fight this lawsuit. Up to this point, it was sort of touch and go. Were they going to do it? Weren't they going to do it? They really weren't really sort of fully into it. And, you know, couldn't we find some kind of settlement? But we're in this deposition, and the guy asks some sort of ridiculous question, and the BSDI lawyer objects. Says, you know, that question is totally irrelevant. You know, he shouldn't have to answer that, you know. And, you know, they argue about it back and forth for a little bit because the judge is going to read this and then decide whether it's admissible. I mean, I still have to answer, but he's going to decide that maybe if it's not admissible, then they can't use that particular quote. So anyhow, they argue back and forth for a while, and we finally get over, and he says, all right, now answer the question. And I said, well, I don't really remember what the question was. Could you read it back? So the court reporter now reads the question back. And the Berkeley lawyer objects, I object to that question, blah, 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 blah. And they get into this big, big, long argument about whether or not I have to answer the question. And, you know, at some point, he's like trying to rebut it, and the Berkeley lawyer is starting to go, and finally the guy that's supposed to be Mr. Composure and is supposed to be upsetting me just turns and says, ladies, just let him answer the question. Well, the two lawyers on either side of me did not really appreciate being referred to as ladies. In particular, the Berkeley lawyer just dug in her heels. She was going to fight this one to the finish, and I knew she was on our side. So the depositions go through. I get deposed. Mike gets deposed. Everybody in sight gets deposed. And eventually then these documents get written and get sent to the judge. And again, it's a request for an injunction against BSDI. The university just immediately capitulates and says, nope, we won't ship out any more Net2 tapes. Like it mattered, right? They're on every FTP site you can imagine. So we didn't care. But, you know, the BSDI, it's more of an issue. They can't obviously just stop shipping at that point. So anyway, they go in front of the judge to have the hearing about the preliminary injunction. And the way preliminary injunctions generally work is each side basically submits their reason on why or why not you should have the preliminary injunction, and then each side also gets to a rebuttal for what the other side's arguments are. So the judge has these four documents. Normally he reads through them, and a preliminary injunction is the judge comes in and says, well, I've read the things, and the answer is yes, you get it, or no, you don't. He can ask a few questions. If there's something that's not entirely clear to him, he can actually quiz the parties. That is usually a maximum of about 10 minutes. But this particular judge was very thoughtful, and he carried on about 2 hours of questioning and presentations by the two sides and so on. And then after that, again, he would normally have issued a ruling, or sometimes they can take it under advisement, well, I want to think about it, you know, and a day or two later they come out. Because after all, this is preliminary injunction, this is, you know, they're being woefully hurt, and we have to stop this immediately. So, you know, he decides he's going to take it under advisement, so I figure, well, you know, they said it wouldn't be long, probably early next week. So the next week comes and goes and drags and drags and drags, and finally at the end of the week, I call up Mary McDonald, the Berkeley lawyer, and I say, so, you know, what's going on? I thought you said it'd be a couple days. And he said, well, actually, you know, he has up to 4 weeks if he wants to take it. And I'm thinking, oh, great. So now we're on pins and needles for 4 weeks to find out what's going to happen. And so, you know, week two goes by, week three goes by. So it comes down to week four. And Friday is, you know, that's the deadline. So at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, which is 5 o'clock on the East Coast, which is where it was being held, I call up Mary McDonald. I said, so what happened? I haven't heard anything. And she said, well, he didn't do anything. I said, well, it's, you know, past 5 o'clock. And she said, so what are you going to do? Hold him in contempt of court? Week five came and went. Week six came, and finally at the end of week six, the judge issues his ruling. Now remember, all he has to do is file, you know, a piece of paper that says yes or no and sign it. But this judge doesn't do that. He issues a 40-page document which basically, first of all, denies the request, and of the 43 things that they'd asked for relief, he basically said, 41 of these are ridiculous and I'm throwing them out on the face of it. Then there's this one that's about copyright, and that, of course, only applies to things that are copyright over about the last 6 months. You can try and make a case about that. And there might be trade secrets in there. You haven't shown me any reason to believe that there are, but I can believe that it might be possible that you would do that. So if you would like to file under those 2 points, and those two alone, I'm willing to have you refile. And but really, this is something that should be dealt with in the state courts first. And then if you don't get injunctive relief there, then it perhaps would be reasonable for you to come and do a filing, you know, back in front of my court. Well, it doesn't take the UCB lawyers very long to figure out what this means, because this is on Friday, and they go, yippee-yay-yay. What we should do is file in California, because basically there's one of the laws that says you can't file, for example, in all 50 states to try and bleed your opponent dry. Once you file in one state, then everything has to be done in that state. And, of course, they were filing in New Jersey because that's where they were located. But if we filed in California state court, we could force them to come out and hire lawyers in California so we could stop traveling there and hiring lawyers in New Jersey, and you know, we'd have the upper hand. So we feverishly work all weekend long to come up with something to file. And, of course, they're going to have a 3-hour window ahead of us because it's going to be 9 o'clock on the East Coast, 3 hours before it's going to be 9 o'clock on the West Coast. So if they are going to do the same thing, they can actually beat us and file in New Jersey. And so we're all like, I wonder if it's going to happen. I wonder if it's going to happen. I wonder if it's going to happen. 9 o'clock rolls around, and they are like standing there when the door opens, and they run in and throw it down. And, of course, you say, well, what could they possibly file for? Well, it's very easy, because in the Berkeley license, if you look at it, it's pretty simple. I'm sure all of you have read it, and it's just a little copyright notice at the top. One, you can't remove the copyright notice, and two, you've got to give due credit to the Regents of the University of California and their contributors. Well, they had, you might find this hard to believe, a lot of Berkeley code in System 5. But first of all, somehow the copyrights had fallen out of a lot of those files. And secondly, their documentation didn't have the requisite thing that said that some of the code in this system comes from the University of California. So we filed and said, well, they have violated the terms of their license with Berkeley. They've removed the copyrights, which they need to put back in, so we want them to reclaim every source tape that they have in the field and get those copyrights put in and redistribute them. And second of all, they failed to provide due credit, so we want them to recall all of their manuals and reprint them with the appropriate thing. And then, because of the fact that they have egregiously failed to give due credit to the university. And there's all these people that are undoubtedly confused about this. We feel that they need to give us relief in this case. So we want full-page ads in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Time, Newsweek, Unix Review. This was filed in the Alameda Court, which happens to be across the street from where the Berkeley lawyers are located, very conveniently located, and very far away from New Jersey. It also, of course, put the stake in the ground so that they were required to battle this in the state of California. Well, of course, there'd be no bias in a state of California court for the University of California. I'm sure they could find a jury of people in Berkeley that knew nothing about the University of California and hence would not be the least bit biased. So, at any rate, about this time, I commissioned another set of T-shirts to be done, and one of them had the demon, and he had taken his trident and he had just stuck it into the orb, which had sort of deflated over the trident, and there was actually sort of Death Star kind of logo on this deflated ball. And the slogan that got selected by the crowd to go underneath this was "Free the Berkeley 4.4." Then there was another shirt that had the guy in little cutoff shorts slam dunking a Death Star through a basketball hoop, and underneath it said "Net 2, USL 0." So about this time, Novell bought USL, and the head of Novell at that time was a guy named Ray Norda. And although he's, of course, immediately asked what does he think about the lawsuit, he says, well, of course, I can't comment on litigation that's in progress. But just as a general feeling, I believe that it's good for companies to compete in the marketplace rather than in courts. And, well, of course, I have no idea what actually happened inside there, but inside that company. But in the fall of 1993, they decide that they are going to start settlement talks, see if we can't find some way of getting out of this without necessarily fighting all the way to the finish. Of course, the people that are in the settlement talks are the same people that have been fighting us tooth and nail for the past 2 years, and you know, we just are not getting very far on these settlement talks. You know, I mean, they're talking about, okay, well, you know, as long as the university agrees to withdraw this, then you know, we promise we won't prosecute you. You know, that's the sort of idea of what their idea of a settlement talk is. Of course, we're supposed to leave BSDI out to hang to dry. Any rate, the settlement talks don't move very fast. And then, surprisingly, a couple months later, all those people depart USL, and other people are put in charge. And suddenly the settlement talks begin moving at a much more quicker pace. And by January of 1994, a settlement had been reached. And, of course, I am signed to a thing which says I can't tell you exactly what the settlement was, but I would say that if you were, for example, to diff, say, Net 2 and 4.4 Lite, that you'd find that several files had disappeared, like about three. You'd see that about 70 USL copyrights had been added with a... It's basically saying that it was copyright by them, but also an agreement that they could be freely redistributed. And in fact, 4.4 BSD Lite was released in June of 1994 with these changes. And basically a letter that said, we agree that Net 2 is contaminated. You may not use it, but if you use 4.4 Lite, then we, you know, everyone, including USL, agrees that there's no problem with that and they aren't going to sue you. So there actually was a fair amount of sales that were generated from 4.4 Lite. A lot of people decided that piece of paper they paid $1,000 for had really won out for them in the end from Net 2. So they anteed up the money for 4.4 Lite because there was a certain guarantee they felt came with that. And so there was actually a fair amount of money that came from the sales of 4.4 Lite. And it was, you know, there was no lawsuit to fight with it anymore. And so, well, what to do with it? So basically... Keith Bostick and I continued working part-time at the university, putting in bug fixes and enhancements and so on as they came into the 4.4 and 4.4 Lite. And when that money ran out, we then released 4.4 BSD Lite Release 2, which came out in June of 1995. And that was basically the last distribution that came out of Berkeley, and it's the last distribution of the BSD series that's ever going to come out of Berkeley. So those of you that are waiting for 4.5 or 4.4 Lite 3 or whatever... It ain't happening. Go get one of the free BSDs that's out there. Oh, I'm not done yet. You thought I was done. Oh, no. I got lots to go. No, the...
Your throat's dry.
Oh, my throat's dry. Okay, just a minute here. I'm ready now. Okay, so what happened after that? Well, the groups that had started with 386 BSD, basically that was being headed up by Bill Jolitz, and he came out with his 0.1 release, and they started creating these various patches and so on that would go on and keep being added and added and added and added to this. And they kept waiting for him to do his next release, but he was another one of these people that sort of wanted it to be right by the time he released it. And he wasn't real good about integrating their changes back in, so the set of patches just kept growing and growing and growing. And the upshot was that they finally got tired of waiting for the final release from Bill Jolitz, and so they formed their own group to start supporting this. And sort of, it's not quite clear what that group would be called. My guess is, out of my memory, which isn't that great, was that it was in fact called NetBSD at that point.
Yep.
And what then happened was that there was sort of a schism that formed in this group. There was a set of people that were interested in basically staying on the bleeding edge of research. They wanted to support a large number of architectures, as 4.4 Lite did, had about four in it. They wanted it to have more. Net distribution basically on the net, so if you weren't smart enough to know how to download it and get it running on your machine, then they probably didn't want you as a user. And so there was a set of people within that group that felt that they really should be trying to get this system out to a larger audience. And they wanted to just concentrate on the most popular architecture, which was the PC. They wanted to put things on CD-ROM so that they could be more widely distributed. They wanted to have installation scripts so you didn't have to be super smart on how to do this. And this is what eventually forked to become the FreeBSD group. So the FreeBSD group sort of concentrated on, you know, getting the most usable, widely distributed system. The NetBSD folks continued on their sort of research and get lots of machines running. And the upshot was that although they had sort of different goals, they still communicated back and forth, stuff that got fixed in one, moved over to the other, and so on. Meanwhile, there was still 386 BSD, which had just started to sort of fade off into the background because Bill Jolitz wasn't releasing additional stuff for that. And so NetBSD and FreeBSD essentially became the main platforms that were out there. Well, of course, when Lite came out, they were forced to start over from scratch. Part of the whole agreement was, I'm guessing, that USL felt that by saying, well, basically you have to throw away everything that's based on Net 2 and start over from Lite, was that they were going to throw a one-year monkey wrench into everybody's systems. But in fact, they had done a fairly good job of isolating the things that they had changed, and so they were able to take Lite and just basically drop the things in, and it took a couple month hiccup, but then they were up and running with Lite. In fact, from my perspective, it was great because it basically was a forced upgrade for everybody, and a bunch of stuff that I'd fixed between Net2 and 4.4 Lite basically was suddenly out there. In fact, when we released Lite2, I was sort of disappointed because it took basically several years before some of that got over into the other systems. I think they just sort of did that to make sure I didn't do this again because it was a big headache for them. At any rate, Bill Jolitz did eventually release his final system. But unfortunately, he had not done the move from Net2 up to the Lite release, and so he got in trouble with USL, and that system basically sort of got sidetracked. And as far as I know, he's never gone back and really fixed that up. So we basically had NetBSD and FreeBSD, and the other sort of effect of this was that there then got to be some dissension within the NetBSD group, so they split again to form OpenBSD and NetBSD. And meanwhile, FreeBSD sort of continued on its way. FreeBSD, because of their early push to really try and get a large user base, certainly today has the largest installed base, although OpenBSD and NetBSD in the past year or so have begun to be serious about getting stuff on CD-ROMs, making the things installable, and trying to push the envelope on their systems. So the upshot is that you're at this FreeBSD conference, you're certainly the largest user population among the free versions of BSDs, but I will point out that the NetBSD people have done a lot of good stuff. The OpenBSD people have as well. And so I'm always pleased to see that, you know, there's a certain amount of camaraderie, which is keeping a flow of ideas back and forth. People often ask me, am I sorry that the BSD sort of splintered this way? And my answer is no, actually. I think the sort of friendly competition that we have is good. I think that at least between NetBSD and FreeBSD, they have really different goals, and having people pursue those different goals is a good idea. Some of the stuff that NetBSD has done, you know, has matured and has gotten over into FreeBSD, and they certainly watch what FreeBSD does and grabs things when that happens. The other thing is that BSD is constantly being flacked for being such a splintered thing. You know, look at Linux, you know, they're all together. Well, there's 12 distributions of Linux out there. You know, which one are we talking about? Yes, the kernel is the same, but just about everything else about them is different. So, in fact, if you know, you look at the installed base of FreeBSD, it can stand up and compete pretty effectively against even something like Red Hat, at least in things like the server market. So I would say that that BSD, if anything, you know, is doing wonderfully. I think growth is good. I'm glad to see that, you know, the charts that Jordan put up earlier with the thing going up. I like that. In fact, if you plot sort of the growth of the BSDs and you'll plot the growth of Linux, the two are in lockstep, except for the fact that BSD is about 2.5 years behind Linux. So if you know, you look at where Linux was 2.5 years ago, that's where BSD is here, and then 6 months later, you know, they're both gone up by the same amount and so on. Of course, at some point, these are going to flatten out, and the hope is, of course, that Linux will flatten out like that, and we'll go rocketing past them. We like to think that Linux, you know, it's one of these things where, you know, it's good to sort of get them sucked in and get them used to the idea of open source, because quite frankly, it's a lot easier to convince a Linux user that they should convert to FreeBSD than it is to convince a Windows user that they should convert to FreeBSD. So I just view it as good feedstock, you know, let them go out there, let them be the pioneers, because it's the pioneers that get the arrows in the back, you know, and it's the settlers that get the land. Okay, so at long last, I have finished pontificating here. And I am ready to begin taking questions. And what I want to do, where's Mr. Microphone? There he is. All right, so if you want to ask a question, raise your hand, and the guy with the microphone is going to come over and hand it to you so that you can be memorialized on tape.
Do you think a convention like this is better suited by being completely towards FreeBSD, or would it be better suited if it was towards all the BSDs at once?
The question, did you get the question on the tape? Great. Okay. My view is that I would prefer to see something which covered all the BSDs. But as a practical matter, somebody would have to organize that, and trying to politically pull that off would be difficult. On the other hand, we sort of get this already, because if you look at the Freenix track that we have at Usenix, we get not only people from all of the BSDs there, we also get a bunch of the Linux crowd there. So in some sense, we sort of have the conference, which is the open source conference. O'Reilly also runs an open source conference in which we get these people together. So I don't feel that it's something that's not being done at all. I mean, there are venues which are managing to do that. So I guess the real question is it useful to have one of these in addition to those others? And I think the answer is yes, because in some sense, you know, FreeBSD is, you know, we're getting an opportunity to get sort of a lot of the core people that are really making things happen in FreeBSD all together here. And rather than argue about, you know, well, should this feature go back and forth or whatever, you know, we can sit down and figure out whether we want block devices in the system or not.
Given that 4.5 BSD is not going to happen, from the free Unixes happening out there, the Linuxes, the NetBSDs, and the FreeBSDs, do you see those as being valid replacements?
Do I see a better replacement than...
Valid replacements.
Oh, valid?
Yeah.
I mean, other than BSD or Linux?
No. In the academic lineage of 4.1, 4.2, 4.3, 4.4, etc., the free Unixes came as... more public sort of contributions. They're public, not academic.
And so do I feel that that's good or bad? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Yeah. I would say, first of all, that although CSRG was located at the university, the vast majority of our contributors came from commercial backgrounds. So a lot of, in some sense, we sort of had the open source movement back in that era. The difference was that we were all under sort of this umbrella, which was this license. But the fact of the matter was that everybody that was sort of working in this area, i.e. in universities or commercial areas, really had access to that license and hence had access to the source code. So although we at Berkeley were the ones that were coordinating it, we were getting a lot of commercial or input from commercial people even in that time. So in that sense, today FreeBSD still gets a lot of stuff commercially. It gets a lot of stuff from the academics, perhaps not as much academic stuff, but certainly some. Okay, what I think was most important that we set up at CSRG was the model which the BSDs use to this day, and that is a notion of a core team, a notion of a set of developers or committers that are sort of the next ring around that, and then an even larger ring of people that are feeding stuff into the committers. The model, of course, was the core team was CSRG. We had a large number of people that had accounts on our machine and the rights to check things in. Just as with FreeBSD, just because you had commit privileges didn't mean you could commit anything to anything, any part of the system. You were supposed to commit just to Telnet or FTP or whatever it was that you were supporting. So we had set up a model which worked well. All of the BSD distributions still use that model. That is, they have a core team, they have a larger set of developers, and another feedstock beyond that. This is in sharp contrast to what we have with Linux, where we have we don't really have a core team per se. I mean, we have Linus at the top, but as the thing gets bigger, he becomes quite a bottleneck. He has a few lieutenants around him, but he still wants to be involved in all the key decision making. And to the extent that we have developers, a lot of them are sort of clustered around things like Red Hat or Debian or SUSE or whatever. And so although they're moving towards this sort of hierarchy of feeding stock in, they haven't really gotten, I would say, nearly as mature as the structures that we had at Berkeley and the structures that are used by the BSDs. So in some sense, I think the what we had to offer from Berkeley is not so much our academic credentials, but setting up this paradigm for how do you have a huge crowd of people feeding things in a coordinated way. Because if you just let everybody mob stuff in, you get a muddled system. You want some people that are sort of thinking things through. You know, somebody's working on patch and someone else is working on diff. But somebody has to say, well, gee, that change you made to diff now means patch doesn't work. You two guys need to sort this out. You know, we don't care. I don't care, which thing changes, but something's got to get fixed here. By having that overall coordination going on, that's what kept the system coherent. And I think the structure that we have here in FreeBSD and in the other BSDs is very important. And I think that's the contribution that Berkeley made. And beyond that, I think that they're going to do just fine by themselves. In fact, I'd say they're doing a great job by themselves. It's wonderful. You know, I got to go on a six-week vacation, and when I came back, lots of wonderful stuff had happened. You know, if I'd gone on a six-week vacation from Berkeley, it would have been horrible. There'd be a huge mess, and there'd be a huge backlog, and it'd be awful. I'm really glad to be retired, I have to say. Okay.
For historical purposes, I wonder if you could relate a story, if you have one, of the first time that somebody gained root access on a BSD system where they nominally would not have that.
What was the first time that a hacker broke in on our system? Maybe I should change that. When was the first time that a hacker broke in on our system and we noticed it? For a long time, it was sort of a non-issue. But eventually we began to notice these things happening. For some reason, our machine was just a target. It's like it had a big kick me sign painted on it or something. So I'm not sure that I know exactly the story that you want me to relate, but there's at least one good one that I have in mind. And that was when somebody had broken into the system. They weren't being particularly malicious, but we just didn't like them breaking in. You just don't like random people that you don't know who they are having root on your machine. So, call me old-fashioned. But, well, what are we going to do? How are we going to figure out where this is coming from? Well, we sort of would trace it back, and eventually we found they were coming across the network, and they were dialed into, some machine at some university or something. And so we call up the university and say, look, someone who's dialing into your machine is basically breaking into our machine. Can we get the logs of, you know, where they're coming from? Well, of course, they were dialing from, you know, they got the phone logs, you know, a month later when the phone bill came from some other machine, you know, somewhere else. And so you talk to them and, you know, someone's dialing out on your machine and dialing into this other machine. So you sort of trace it back, you know, bit by bit by bit by bit. And eventually what you find out is that it ends in the Netherlands. So we have people that we know in the Netherlands, and the Netherlands has pretty strong privacy stuff, I mean, more so than even the typical EC countries, and so they're not about, it's like, you know, hacking's not a crime, you know, he's not doing anything malicious, you know, we're not going to tell you where he's coming from. But we have our ways. We know people that work in certain places where they can get those records. And so eventually, to make a long story short, this thing gets traced back to somebody that's dialing out of some building in Amsterdam. And, of course, the authorities aren't going to do anything about it because, of course, we shouldn't know this in the first place. But one of our good friends in Holland lived near Amsterdam. And so we said, well, could you just, like, go around and see what, you know, what this building is? And so he goes around. You know, he understands that someone's dialing in from there. And so he goes up and just looks like sort of an ordinary house. He knocks on the front door. And this woman comes to the front door, a sort of middle-aged woman. And he says, excuse me, ma'am, but we've been told that there's somebody seems to be using the phone in your house to dial and break into computers. Do you have any idea? She slaps her and, oh, my son, what's he up to? Disappears up the stairs. And, well, it stopped. That was it.
clarification rather than a question.
Yes.
You weren't quite sure about the order in which NetBSD and FreeBSD split off. And
yes.
My memory of the situation is that NetBSD split off from 386BSD and then sometime later FreeBSD split off also from 386BSD. So FreeBSD didn't derive from NetBSD. They're both offshoots from the Jolits.
Okay.
Because in two
you
separate...
were a bit more patient than they were.
Yeah. That, two sets of people got impatient with Bill Jolits, but one lot were
more impatient
people
than
the others, which explains the difference in personalities, I think.
Okay. I have nothing to add to that comment. I believe it to be true. Okay. Any more questions?
One of the things that comes up on the advocacy list often is the question of the name. FreeBSD,
mm-hmm.
and the question of changing the name to be more politically correct or whatever have you for commercial users.
Open source BSD?
Well, could you talk a little bit about how the BSD group allowed these particular names to be chosen, if there was such a discussion?
I'm not aware of how the names came to be chosen, so you'd have to talk to the individual groups and go back in time, probably, to try and get those answers.
So what do you run at home?
BBSD!
I try and not show particular favoritisms to one system or another system for the simple reason that you know, perhaps then I can act as more of a moderator between the groups. So at various times, I have run all of the different BSDs, including BSDI. When I finally got rid of my HP 300 and had to replace it, I thought long and hard about what I was going to buy, and then I looked at the prices of PCs versus anything else, and I bought a PC. So at the moment, I run BSDI on my laptop, and I run FreeBSD on the workstation that sits on my desk. And because I've been doing some development work on FreeBSD, I also was... Walnut Creek was kind enough to send me a dual processor machine that I could use for my testing. When they were setting it up, they said, well, we've got this dual processor. Are you interested? And I said, yes, But actually, since I do a lot of stuff based on file systems and I/O, I would really sort of like to have more than an IDE disk on it, which is what I have on the thing that sits under my desk. Someone had said, "Well, IDE SCSI, it's all about the same." So they said, "Well, what did you really have in mind?" I said, "Well, I'd like a high-end Adaptec and ultra-wide SCSI, couple disks, And they said, "Well, that might take a little while." That's okay. I went on vacation for 6 weeks, and when I came back, they said, "Well, we got your machine ready. We're going to ship it to you." And so it came, and it's got an Adaptec 2940 on it and two fast SCSI disks. And so I said, "Well, let me check out this this claim that IDE and SCSI are compatible with each other." So I did my first test, and I basically did some brute force writing big files into the IDE disk and just writing it straight to the raw disk and reading back and so on. And the answer is you get anywhere from 3.5 to about 4 megabytes per second, depending on what you're doing. And I have two IDE disks on there, and they're different masters. So I said, "Well, let's see what the effect is of doing both disks at the same time." And the answer is that when you run both disks at the same time, you get about 2.1 megabytes per second on each of them. Yeah, about half. Mm-hmm. A little better than half, but not by much. And then I said, "Well, maybe it's whether I use DMA on it or not, because these are high-end IDE disks, so they can do DMA, and pipe burst stuff and so on." So I turned that on and off to see what effect it had. And in fact, the throughput rate is virtually identical. It's just a matter of whether it takes 10% of the CPU or 40% of the CPU. Okay, so then I said, "All right, let's try out this SCSI system." And so I fired it up and did the same test. And what you find is that you get about 14 megabytes per second when you write or read to one disk. And when you read and write to two disks, you get about 27 megabytes per second. So I've decided that perhaps this thing about IDE being faster than SCSI may not be all that the IDE manufacturers would have you believe. But then I decided, someone said, "Well, the small file stuff works better on IDE." And I found this a little odd. I couldn't quite figure out how that would be. But, full testing, okay, let's do it. So I tried some of my small file tests on IDE and then on SCSI. And, in fact, the IDE on the small file tests does comparably to the SCSI. In fact, does slightly faster. And to make a long story short, what I found out is that there's the cache on the IDE basically lies to you. So as soon as the data's in the cache, it says it's done. Now, it's not battery backed up cache or anything like that, but wrong answers can be delivered quickly. So.
Okay, another religious question.
Uh-oh.
Could you discuss the history of the Berkeley Daemon, please?
Could I discuss the history of the Berkeley Daemon? Well, that's a fairly long one, let's get this down to beer drinking kinds of time. It's a good beer drinking kind of question now that you mention it. So much better. Okay, so to start the story at the beginning, let me tell you when I was a lad. No. Multics actually was the first system that had the notion of daemon processes. The idea being these would be processes that would sort of run around in the background that you would not directly run, but would do things on your behalf. And so, of course, when Unix came along, daemon processes also got created. And so when USENIX was getting ready to celebrate their 10th anniversary, they decided to commission a T-shirt. There was this guy, Mike O'Brien, who was one of the active members of the USENIX, I don't know if he was on the board, but certainly active in the organization, had this safe that was in his apartment, but he didn't know what the combination to it was. And he had this friend who was an artist and also a locksmith. And so he sort of cut a deal that if this guy could sort of open this safe for him and figure out what the combination was, then he could arrange to give him some money to do some artwork. And so that seemed like a fair trade. He got the safe, he got the artwork, and was out a little bit of money. So the idea was, he said, "Well, I want you to sort of get the idea of daemon processes, something that would show that." And he showed him a picture of a PDP-11, and so he did the famous, now famous, PDP-11, USENIX 11, 10th anniversary T-shirt. It shows a PDP-11, and it's got sort of pipes sort of in front of it, and there's little sort of daemon characters running around with pitchforks and pails and things, and there's like a pipe that's labeled null, and there's a pail underneath it, and a little demon managing it, and so on. So that was sort of the first graphical representation that we had of a daemon. And they're pretty simplified. They don't have near the sophistication of the daemons that you see today. They're just sort of little stick figure guys. But that sort of set the idea, the tone, that we could come up with a character that would represent these daemon processes. So when it came time to do the 4.2 manuals, we decided, well, we have to have some cover art. And so there was a black and white daemon, sort of a line drawing daemon that was done. This appeared on the cover, and he's standing there with his trident, and there's this glowing orb that's sort of casting a shadow over him, and on the orb it says Unix. So this came out, and AT&T just went absolutely nonlinear. How can you put Unix on the cover of a BSD manual? BSD is not Unix. Get that off. So when the reprints came out, we just carefully airbrushed Unix off the glowing orb. So he's just standing there, and there's a glowing orb. Okay, fine. Well, so that carried on. In fact, there were some colorized versions of that that got done, although never on the manuals. When we decided that we wanted to do the 4.3 book, we actually decided this in very early 80s. But of course, if we're going to write something about the internals, we didn't have the freely redistributable system at that time, so we figured we'd have to get the permission of AT&T. Or the publisher said, basically, you've got to get permission of AT&T before we're going to publish it. So we went to them and said, well, you know, conceptually, do you have a problem with us writing a book about the internals of BSD? And they said, well, you know, we can't really answer that question without really seeing exactly what you had in mind. So why don't you write the book, and then we'll take a look at it and let you know if we can publish it. Well, you know, that just didn't inspire us to write that book. So time passed. And finally, in 1986, the Bach book came out. And we said, hey, they've done it. You know, they've put out a book that basically is in more detail about the internals of the system than we actually intend to do. Let's go. And Addison Wesley agreed with us. They said, fine, you write it, we'll publish it. If there's any problem, AT&T can talk to us. So in 1988, we basically had written the 4.3 book. And, of course, we needed cover art for that. And so at this point, Sam had left Berkeley. He was working at Lucasfilm. And one of the things that Lucasfilm was trying to do was to develop this system for computer-aided animation. And so they were working on, you know, they knew all of the computer graphics stuff, but they really didn't know what kind of an interface someone that actually did animation for a life would really like. But there was this guy named John Lasseter, who was a head animator for Walt Disney, and he was due for his sabbatical, and he was sort of interested in computer stuff. So he was doing a one-year sabbatical at Lucasfilm, and basically they were using him to design the user interface for this animation station that they were working on. And so while he was there, Sam went to him and said, hey, you know, could you draw us a daemon? And so he drew the one that appeared on the face of the cover of the 4.3 book, the one that is sort of the canonical standard one that you see on a lot of the FreeBSD and other stuff. And the reason that it has that sort of Walt Disney-esque look to it is, well, because it was done by a head animator of Walt Disney. And so anyway, we got this drawing done, and I paid what seemed like a small ransom for it, something like $1,000. And so then I presented it to Addison Wesley and said, well, this is what we want on the cover of the book. And they looked at it and they go, you want a cartoon on the cover of a technical book? Oh, nobody would take that seriously. You can't do that. We said, no, really, trust us. It'll be fine. And they're like, you've never written a book before. We're the marketing specialists when it comes to textbooks. We know what we're talking about. It's like, look, I know, you know, I'm sure you know a lot about marketing textbooks, but please, just, you know, we don't ask for much. Just put it on the cover of the book. And they're like, okay, you know, if the authors complain enough, we'll do it over, you know, our strenuous objection. So they get it, and of course they airbrush out the glowing orb because they don't understand what that is. So it's just he's just standing there with this big shadow going out behind him with no light source in front of him. It's just a black cover, right? It's like it's midnight with a huge shadow behind him. But, well, you know, marketing, what can I say? So the book comes out, and the effect is that they print 5,000 copies of it. It comes out right at the time of a January Usenix, and boom, every copy is sold like within a week. And there's this huge demand backlog, and they're like, oh my goodness, it sold, what a surprise. So they printed up like 11,000 copies, and all those sold out in a couple weeks. And so it, you know, it just took off. And in fact, the guy that was in charge of that book, he said he went into his meeting at the end of the year where they're basically evaluating how everybody did, and he was wearing one of the BSD t-shirts. And this is in a company where it's like normally starched white shirts, right? He said he got the biggest bonus of any of the editors that year. So anyway, that was the 4.3 daemon. And so, you know, time passed, and it came time to do the 4.4 book. And we'd been through, we'd had a couple of the t-shirts from the lawsuit with various things that I described earlier. But part of the settlement was that we agreed not to yank each other's chains. So I agreed I wouldn't sell any more nasty anti-AT&T USL t-shirts. So those had to go out of print. But if you have one, you don't have to return it. Anyhow, it was time to put something on the cover of the 4.4 book. And I wanted to, you know, I wanted to get something, you know, to sort of keep moving the thing forward. And so I wanted to go back to John Lasseter. Well, John Lasseter had, in fact, at the end of his sabbatical, decided that this computer graphics stuff was pretty cool. And maybe he you know, didn't really want to go back to Walt Disney and drawing those little things by hand anymore, because you could do so much better with these computer stations. And meanwhile, Lucasfilm was spun off and became Pixar. And unsurprisingly, Walt Disney entered into an agreement with Pixar that they would do a series of feature-length animations. And, of course, John Lasseter was in charge of, you know, he was the head of the whole production. And so he was busily at that time working on Toy Story. Meanwhile, I wanted to get him to draw another demon. Well, he was a little busy, can you imagine? But what I found was, I found his secretary, and so I sort of would go in and talk to her and say, you know, is there any chance that you could, like, get John to do this and, you know, bring her a bunch of flowers each time or a box of chocolates or something. Anyway, it sort of worked, and eventually she just sort of put a piece of paper in front of him and sat him down with a pen and said, draw. And she said he actually sat there and his hand was sort of shaking because it had been 5 years since he'd actually held a pen to draw an animation cell, and he wasn't sure he was going to remember how to do it. But at any rate, I had told them that what I wanted was something where, you know, I was tired of the demon just standing there. I wanted a little more action. So he had drawn up a couple of pencil sketches. He had one where the demon sort of had his legs all spun up and was tearing across. I said, yeah, that looks good. That looks like a system in motion. So anyhow, he ended up doing this one here, which is the demon is, you know, taken off and trying to stab this glowing orb, the one that he had managed to catch earlier when it was an AT&T logo. But the glowing orb is caught onto this trick, so the glowing orb takes off like a shot across the screen, or across the picture, and the demon is in hot pursuit. Well, of course, it came time to put it onto the 4.4 book, and, well, the marketing people said, that looks much too much like a sperm cell. That will never sell in the Midwest. So they airbrushed that out. But Keith Bostick's attitude was, sure, go ahead, get them, you know, slap a thing across the cover that says, banned in Oklahoma. It'll raise sales. I will, however, point out that although they felt it necessary to airbrush out John Lasseter's signature in 4.3 days, by the time of 4.4, the marketing people actually knew who John Lasseter was because Toy Story had come out by that time, and so they felt it was appropriate to leave his signature there. So you'll see that on the cover of the 4.4 book. And I'm just wondering how many people bought the book thinking it had something to do with Toy Story. Okay, where's Mr. Microphone here?
Yeah. I attended the first 2 days of the tutorial. On behalf of the people that are going to attend the next tutorial, I want to say thanks. I learned a lot. I like your presentation style, and I like your sense of humor. The question I thought up a little while ago was, what do you see as the major impediments, pick any number, to FreeBSD gaining a wider user base? And go as wide as you want with this question. It's just something I thought up.
How would FreeBSD get a wider user base? I think they're actually doing a pretty good job of it right now.
The impediments.
What are the impediments to it? The impediments to it are two things. Linux. It clearly got the mind share and has got the press today. Although I don't view, as I said earlier, I don't view that as all bad. To me, the most important thing is open source. The high order bit is open source. Whether it's Linux or FreeBSD or whatever is a second order effect. The thing that's the most critical is that we move to a paradigm of open source out there in the commercial world and that they figure out a way to make that work. Okay. Having said that, yes, I would rather see it be FreeBSD that succeeds rather than Linux. But you know, Linux has done a great job of evangelizing. They're going out there and they're changing the corporate minds. In some sense, you know, the corporate minds will say, okay, this open source thing is good, Linux is good. The impediment is that we then somehow need to find how to get that mind share and go out there and say, okay, now that you've decided that open source is good, actually we can do even better than what you already have. And that's going to be name your BSD. Okay, I think that technically, at least today, we can still do that. I mean, the Linux has got a big jump because they got more people working on it, but I would say the core of people that are working on FreeBSD, it's pretty astounding. I mean, just watching the commit list go by is an amazing thing for me. And, you know, compared to what, for example, we did at the CSRG, I could, you know, look at every commit that went by at CSRG. No way I could look at every commit that goes by on the FreeBSD list, and that's if I spent all my time doing it. But the things that I do look at, I mean, I look at the things that I care about, and, you know, although I don't agree with every change that gets made, I'm very impressed with what happens there. I look at Linux, and they are making more changes faster, but they're less focused. They're trying to get every single piece of hardware, whereas FreeBSD says, look, we're going to go after the high-end hardware because that's the stuff that really matters the most. And so I think they're doing a good job of saying, all right, we can't do as much as Linux does, but let's, you know, go after the important part. So I think that technically it's going to be necessary for FreeBSD to keep its focus. And as it gets bigger, it's going to be harder to keep that focus on. Core group is 16 people now. It's, you know, it's only growing. It's not likely to shrink. And as you get past about 10 people, just having all those people communicate with each other and keep track of what's going on, you're starting to get into crowd control. And so one of the impediments is how can we grow? How can we continue growing and still maintain the level of quality and focus that we have now? And I think one of the big impediments would be that FreeBSD would be a success disaster. I mean, suddenly all the Linux people say, wow, this FreeBSD thing, this is better. And we suddenly get this huge sucking sound, which is, you know, all of our free time to try and bring other people up to speed. So in some sense, we need to keep our eye on the ball. We need to figure out how we can get bigger and still continue to do a good job of it. And, you know, if the marketing people do too good a job of getting FreeBSD out there, we may find ourselves, you know, fighting some of the same battles that Linux has by its explosive growth recently.
I work slower.
Defining aspects. Yeah. One of the defining aspects of BSD is TCP/IP. As I understand, in the early days, there were two versions of TCP/IP available, and that one got chosen over the other through a competition sponsored by DARPA. Could you go into that to some detail?
You'll have to buy one of the videotapes because I actually told that entire story. So,
it's part of the drinking game.
Okay. Basically,
I went to the Siebel conference and Apple's got some pretty neat stuff happening in terms of the macOS 10. My question is, how does the macOS 10 underlying OS fit in with the BSD, FreeBSDs, the OpenBSD, etc.? And also the question of the PDF issue, because they're planning on using PDF as their display layer.
I'm not sure that, I mean, I haven't studied the macOS 10 enough to really be able to answer that question. Actually, there's someone in the front that wants the microphone here, so he's been waiting a long time. I haven't really studied the macOS 10 all that much. I had several people from their development group take one of my courses, so I actually got, you know, sort of this micro shot, because they started in September, went all the way through the beginner course, then were foolish enough to take the code reading course, which goes from January to May, reading War and Peace twice, you know, in 15 easy weeks. And so during that period, I sort of saw what was going on there, or got some feedback from them. And it looked like they, you know, there was a lot of BSD in technology and what they were doing, and it looked like, you know, it ought to be a pretty cool thing. But beyond that, I haven't really studied enough to give you a good answer to your question. However, there are a number of people that are from that project running around here. Clark Warner is sort of the head honcho of that group, so you should buttonhole him and ask a question to him, because I'm sure he could give you a much better answer.
Tomorrow at 1:30.
Tomorrow at 1:30 is the answer to that question.
Okay. System 5 has...
Can you put it closer?
System 5 has RCD directories for every run level, which permits you to start in a selected order your daemons and also to stop them when the system comes down. Don't you think it would be interesting for the BSD systems to have something similar? Or
yeah, the basic point is that System 5 has a much more sort of controllable startup and shutdown procedure, and in particular allowing you to start subsystems and stop subsystems and so on. I have to say also that NT does as well. NT has really done a good job of sort of figuring out what depends on what other things. And so if you're going to start something up that won't run unless INETD is also running, it will basically make sure that INETD runs before it starts these other things. And so all these dependencies are tracked. This is something that I think that needs to get put into the BSD world, and it needs to get put into the Linux world as well. That falls into the scope of one of those projects which is boring, and hackers don't really want to do it. As we're listening to the core team talking today about, you know, why don't you do documentation? It's like, well, I'd rather paint the ceiling of my living room. that when you have volunteers, it's tough to get them to do stuff that they don't particularly want to do. And unfortunately, that's just not all that glamorous of a project, and it's a lot of work. I think this is actually one of the areas where the open source companies have a lot to offer. And you look at something like SendMail, and they basically hired a bunch of people to sit down and write a graphical user interface that has little messages for like every possible thing you could ever do to a SendMail configuration file. You know, bless them that they could find somebody that they could pay enough money to do that for. And people are willing to pay for that because although hackers basically view GUI interfaces as an obstruction to getting work done, there are a large number of people out there who view graphical user interfaces as the only way that they want to talk to their computers. And luckily, there are people with lots of money that are willing to pay for that kind of thing. So there are a whole class of things that just don't work well in the volunteer model, and that's where the Red Hats of the world and the SendMails of the world really have a lot to offer and pushing forward the open source envelope.
Where do you see the Star BSDs in the next 1 to 2 years, and what do you think the commercial companies such as like Apple can provide to the BSD development process?
Well, to quote another famous developer, I see world domination. As for what companies like Apple have to offer, I think the answer to my previous question would be basically the same answer to that, and that is there are a class of problems which the volunteer organizations just don't want to or won't solve that need to be solved in order to move open source into a wider sphere of users, get it past the hackers, get it out into the point-and-click crowd. And to the extent that those companies do that and do it in an open source model, they're helping the open source movement. It's really the commercial companies that are going to take open source to the next step. I mean, it's all well and good for us to talk about it and pass our CDs among ourselves, but when we can start getting onto the desktop of major companies, get into the servers of major companies, then we're starting to move out and get beyond just the set of people that we've had traditionally. And the commercial companies are the ones that are going to help make that happen.
Speaking of which, when you started with BSD, did you ever expect to see it used someday to
construct a midway video game?
To
make a midway video game.
Ah, yes. Did I expect to see it be a midway video game? Well, probably I wouldn't have guessed that. But I have to say that one of the very first talks that I went to at one of the European Unix conferences was entitled /dev/kidney. And This was basically, they were using Unix to run a kidney dialysis machine. And I thought to myself, I sure hope I don't ever need kidney dialysis. Somehow I just viewed myself sitting there just as it was doing some critical operation when it did panic, freeing free inode. Okay. Anybody else? All right.
Any of the free Unixes now as a dialysis machine?
Would I trust any of the free Unixes now as a dialysis machine? If my choice was NT, you bet I would.
If you had three graduate students and 1 year, what would their projects be?
If I had three graduate students right this minute to do stuff, let's see. One of them I would get to put in the locking that I need to do snapshots. One of them I would get to write the MFS file system layout to replace the MFS that we have now, so we would have a true replacement that would plug in under UFS. And the third one I would basically... actually, I was going to say work on the swap code, but actually Matt Dillon's been doing a lot of that, so that's that area... is no longer a complete rat hole anymore. So, what would I do? Probably I'd get the other one to do a lot of the VNode. I got it. I'll have them merge VNodes and objects. We'll get VObjects, and I can finally convince Mike that I have the data structure that will take over the kernel. Okay, well, I think we've had more than enough of all this. I want to thank you all for coming and enduring the... my endless chatting, and go out there and finish the rest of the beer.
Basically...